In the name of the Father, of the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Today is March 31st, year 2013, and it's Easter Sunday. Christ is truly risen.
Hallelujah.
And don't let the apostate Jews or anyone else lie to you. Christ is truly risen. As a matter of fact, I just spoke with him this morning. You don't like it? Tough. That's your problem. Now, title of the lecture on this Easter season is The Desecration of St. Peter's Basilica. Just as God, speaking to the holy prophet Ezekiel, condemned the apostate Jews and their desecration of God's home in Jerusalem and the temple with idols and naked art and pornography, so likewise, God, speaking to the prophet Ezekiel during a new covenant era, condemns apostate Catholics and their desecration of God's home in Rome and the churches in Rome with idols, naked pictures, and with pornography. Now, you mentioned pornography. Yes, pornography. We don't have just naked pictures. We have people doing pornographic things in those pictures on top of it. Yes, in churches in Rome. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't just Rome. There were churches throughout the whole world, so-called Catholic churches, have been desecrated for a long time, even before the churches in Rome were desecrated. But this lecture is going to concentrate on the desecration of St. Peter's Basilica, because it's the main church, one of the main churches in Rome. Now, I'm going to quote from the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 8. And this was the prophet Ezekiel when God lifted him up and took him over to the temple in Jerusalem to see the abominations. Ezekiel chapter 8. The likeness of a hand was put forth and took me by a lock of my head. And the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven and brought me in the vision of God into Jerusalem, Rome. Near the inner gate, the gate or door of St. Peter's Basilica, where was set the idol jealousy to provoke to jealousy. And he said to me, Son of man, dost thou see, thinkest thou, what these are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel, apostate Catholics, committed here, that I should depart far off from my sanctuary and turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations? And he brought me to the door of St. Peter's Basilica, and I saw idols, false gods, devils, naked humans, pornography, spiritual and physical fornication. And he brought me in by the door of the gate of the Lord's house, and behold, women sat there mourning for Adonis. And I gave the Catholic commentary on that Ezekiel 8:14. Adonis, the favorite of Venus, slain by a wild boar, as famed by the heathen poets, and which, being here represented by an idol, is lamented by the female worshippers of that goddess. This idol, which the Egyptians called Osiris, was placed in a coffin and bewailed till it was pretended he was to come to life, when rejoicings took place. Obscene pictures were carried about, and the more honest pagans were ashamed of these practices, which began in Egypt and became almost general. Moses alludes to them in Leviticus 19:27, Deuteronomy 14:1. These things were done in Rome, in the so-called Catholic churches. Same things that the Jews did. We will now show you, when we go through the evidence, and you're going to see how, and we're going to take a closer look at how apostate Catholics have desecrated God's home in Rome, in St. Peter's Basilica. You're going to see a pantheon of idols, false gods, false religions, immodesty, naked pictures, mixed with the pictures of the true God and the true religion, as if that would make up for it. How dare, that's even on top of it, a sacrilege to mix the true God with those things. And we're going to start out at the door, which you now see before you. The first thing you notice is the sheer size of the doors. They're very big. You can see how they are in relation to a human being. So therefore, the idols that are desecrating St. Peter's Basilica, which are on this door, are not hidden. They're not put in a secret place where maybe only a few people who know about it can see it. It's notorious. It's in your face. And it is in a place where people need to go to get into the church. So it's absolutely impossible that they cannot say that they have not seen it or they didn't know it was there. And then when you go inside the church, we got major problems in there also. We're concentrating on the door right now. You can see the size of this door. It's notorious idolatry. We're reading from the Psalm 73, 3-4. Lift up thy hands against their pride unto the end. See what things the enemy hath done wickedly in the sanctuary. And they that hate thee have made their boasts in the midst of the solemnity. They have set up their ensigns for signs. Catholic commentary on that is, the doors of the temple were very lofty. The idolatrous ensigns were fixed there. During the Old Covenant era, they put their idols up on the doors of the temple. And now we're going to look at this door. The first thing we're going to see at this door is their deception. How they mix the true God with the false God, just like the Jews did. Syncretism. And our Lord said, when you mix the both, you do not have him. You cannot put the true God with false gods. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not have strange gods before thee. Exodus 22, Deuteronomy 5, 7. And when you try to have both of those things side by side, you desecrate and you deny the true God. And it doesn't matter if you tell me, well, we didn't really believe in those gods. You glorified them. You put them up in public in a positive light. You show that you like them, you love them, and you're telling the people a story about these false gods and these idols in a positive light. And you're putting them up side by side, as you can see with these first pious pictures we're going to look at on the six main panels over here. And that's just to throw you off a little bit and say, well, you have to put something in here. They're not going to believe they're not even going to pretend they're in a Catholic church. So you want to have something in here. So we know where, you know, here's, it's like the Pantheon, you know. They have all the false gods, and then I think the one pagan Roman Emperor Augustus wanted to put Jesus up in there with the whole Pantheon of gods and add them to it. That's what they've done on this door. So you can see these first six panels, you've got some pious pictures here. Now the six panels which you see, which are in the more prominent position, have a picture of Jesus and Mary, St. Peter and St. Paul, and the crucifixion of St. Peter, and the martyrdom of St. Paul. All right? But let's take a look how these six pious pictures are overwhelmed and surrounded by false gods, idols, naked pictures, pornography on this very door. Besides the martyrdom of St. Peter, we also see this quote-unquote pious plaque, an engraving of Roma holding Mars, naked satyrs, a drunken satyr with Pudi, an old satyr with Pudi, a leer in a cart pulled by satyrs, and naked Pudi holding up the panel with two sets of Gryphon. Here is a close-up of Roma holding a statue of Mars. And this is a close-up of the naked satyrs. And this is a close-up of the drunken satyr with Pudi. And here's a close-up of the old satyr with Pudi. And here's a close-up of the leer in a cart pulled by satyrs. And here's a close-up of naked Pudi holding up the panel with two sets of Gryphon. A Gryphon is a mythological creature with the head and wings of an eagle and the body of a lion. All you got to do is take a closer look, and you don't need eyeglasses neither. These doors are very big. We're going to start looking at, we're going to show you here with the borders over here. Here we have a picture of Churchy transforming men into beasts. Now, before I go on, if you want to get an explanation of all these false gods and their idols and their false religious teachings about what these things are, you can read my book. I go into about a paragraph, no more than two paragraphs, describing what these false gods are and these mythological creatures are. I can only describe in detail maybe two or three of them during this lecture. But you can read the book and I tell you what all these things are. Next, we're looking at Zeus in the form of an eagle abducting Ganymede for his lover and cupbearer. This one is one of the ones I'm going to comment on. Now, this is reading from the book what we have on it. When you read about this, this has several implications. In Greek mythology, Ganymede is a divine hero whose homeland was Troy. And he's supposed to, Homer describes Ganymede as the most beautiful of mortals. He was a boy, a very beautiful boy. One day when Ganymede was in the field, he was seen by Zeus, who lusted after him and abducted him in the form of an eagle to be his lover and cupbearer in Olympus. Zeus removed his daughter Hebe as cupbearer to make room for Ganymede, and Hera, wife of Zeus, was mad with jealousy and rage when she saw that Ganymede replaced the love of Zeus for her. In poetry, Ganymede is a symbol of homosexual desires. Many famous artists, such as heretical artists, abominable artists, such as Michelangelo, Rembrandt, and Rubens, have painted the rape of Ganymede by Zeus. And you can look at those pictures there also. Is it anything else coming to your mind when we're reading this? Not only we got a false god on here, Zeus, and the whole false story of his false religion with this Ganymede, we got him raping a young boy. What do we call that today? Pedophilia. Pedophilia. And it runs wild amongst apostate Catholics. Homosexuality and pedophilia. You got that picture on the door? You got that curse. You got those demons in there from the very moment that that picture went up on that door. What kind of a picture is this to put up in God's home? What kind of a picture is this? Pedophilia. There it is. For men to be this bad, they had to be bad several hundred years before that, before this even. Now we're going to get into the next picture. We see here Mercury lulling Argus to sleep. Then we see the false god Mercury killing Argus and Juno removing Argus's 100 eyes. And in this picture, in this sculpture we see on the door, we see a goose from the temple of Juno saving Rome from the Gauls. Now we see Nessus abducting Deianira. Here we see a picture of Persephone, daughter of Zeus, gathering flowers. And in this picture we see Pluto, aka Hades, raping Persephone and the abduction of Europa by Zeus as a white bull in the lower left. Another rape scene. Very common on these panels. As pornography. What is this doing in God's home? You would expect to find this in a pornographic magazine. And some false gods. This is all false gods. That's the worst part. The false gods is the worst part. The nakedness is the Romans 1 curse and comes with that. Next picture we see here, Cadmus and the dragon. A Catholic picture to replace this would be St. George slaying the dragon. And the next picture is another rape. The rape of the Sabines by the Romans, right? Now we have in this picture, Leda seduced and raped by Zeus in the form of a swan, which is also implicates bestiality. Zeus takes on all these different shapes, I guess. What a demon. That's Satan. You know who Zeus is, really. If he ever appeared to anybody, it's the devil appearing in his form. And this is the devil can do this stuff. To confirm them in their apostasy, in their idolatries. In this next picture, we see Hercules fights the Nemean lion. And Hercules fights Antaeus. You got a lot of, they were really obsessed with Hercules and Venus. We'll get into that later, maybe even other videos and show you this, but Hercules, because it's like Superman, they're putting their trust, that's humanism. They're putting their trust in their physical strength and not in God. Remember what earlier said about the giants of the earth? I did not give them the victory, the big men of war. No, I gave it to those who were faithful. They were obsessed with Hercules. A Catholic picture to replace this would be Samson, who got his power from the one true God. In this next picture, we see Romulus and Remus suckled by the wolf and two satyrs. Now, a satyr is a half man and a half goat. A centaur is a half man and a half horse. And you got centaurs and satyrs all over these churches in Rome, just loaded down. Not just Rome, but we're concentrating on Rome now. It actually started outside of Rome first and entered into Rome. Next picture, we have another rape. Pan raping Syrinx, and a satyr playing pipes. In the next picture, we have Theseus slaying the half-man, half-bull Minotaur. Now, mind you, this is supposed to be a Catholic church, what you're looking at here. Greets everybody. You can't get in the church unless you go through that door. Unless they have a back door somewhere for some, I don't know. But even when you go in the church, it's bad. Anyway. In the next picture, you have Icarus and his wings. In this next picture, you have Cupid, the god of desire. And in the next picture, we see Deucalion and Pyrrha and their false heretical version of the flood and the repopulation of the world. This is another one I'm going to talk about in a little bit of the detail. In Greek mythology, Zeus decided to end the Bronze Age with a flood. Deucalion and his wife Pyrrha were the only survivors. Once the flood was over, the couple were on land again. Deucalion consulted an oracle of Themis about how to repopulate the earth. He was told to throw rocks over his shoulders. You can see him in his picture throwing the rocks over his shoulders. So they both threw rocks over their shoulders, and the rocks soon began to lose their hardness and change their form. Their mass grew greater, and the beginning of human form emerged. The parts that were soft and moist became skin. The veins of the rock became human veins, and the hardest parts of the rocks became bones. The stones thrown by Pyrrha became women. Those thrown by Deucalion became men. That's on the door. Now, can anybody think of what really belongs up there? The true story, not the heretical, blasphemous, idolatrous story. What belongs up there instead of this?
Noah's Ark.
Noah's Ark. The true story, which is the biblical story, not the heretical one, is that Noah and his seven family members came off the ark after the flood. They are the only human beings alive. And they repopulated the earth. His sons Shem, Japheth, and Ham repopulated the earth. What is this story here? It doesn't have the true God. It's got these false people given the power to be able to create human beings. And by throwing rocks over their shoulders, this is an abomination. This is a heresy. This is idolatry. This is a false heretical history of creation and of the flood. And it's on the door in God's home in St. Peter's Basilica. And by the way, folks, I call these idols you're looking at the door, on the door, the enemies on the gate. The enemies on the gate. And later on, we're going to show you the enemies in the gate when we go inside the joint. It's very hard. You know what's the hardest thing about me to do these lectures? I'm so righteously angry, I want to rip them to pieces. And it's going to happen, believe me. Everyone who's dead and in hell now is being ripped to pieces more than I could. But even now, while I'm alive, God's wrath is going to come down on his people and everyone's going to see it. The next picture we have here in the panel is Dionysius and the pirates. Now we see some mythological Gorgon creature. Now we're looking at some of Aesop's fables and descriptions of that. And now here we see what is called a pooty. Now, people don't know that. It looks, this is the stuff, not only is the doors got pooty on them, the whole church is loaded with these. A lot of people seen these. And I'm going to take a little time to talk about these little pooties. All right? A lot of people say they're angels. These fat, ugly, demonic-looking creatures they call angels, naked, butt naked, with wings floating around. Now, I'll tell you the first thing I thought when I was a kid. Common sense tells you these things. I says, boy, that's disgusting. And I tell you, and it is. If that's the way an angel looks, they're pretty pathetic. It's really a blasphemy against God's creation and his angels. It's sacrilege. It's desecrating the angels. It's a blasphemy against God's angel. It was given Antichrist to blaspheme his angels. Those fat, ugly, little, butt-naked babies with wings on them are not angels. It comes from the mythological gods, things called pooties. And they're imp-like creatures. And we're going to read about the history on it right now. I never liked them, sir. Never from day one. They're all over the place. And they're naked. Almost 99% of the time, they're absolutely, completely naked. All right, now, they say, a pooto is a figure depicted as a chubby male child, usually nude and sometimes winged. His behavior is the same as that of an imp demons. That's what they really are. They are demons, little demons floating around. They have the same behavior as the imps. The Pooty, which is the plural, originated in mythology as companions of the goddess Venus. Eros, the Greek god of love, and the companion of Venus was a Pooty. We look at one of these paintings, these mythological paintings with a Pluto on it. It's a painting of Venus and Eros. The figure of the Pluto, often portrayed as a mischievous baby, made frequent appearances in the art and literature of the Renaissance Italy, commonly called spiritelli, or sprites, or Pluti, embodied a minor species of demon. They included natural spirits, animal spirits, the spirits of sight and sound, as well as hobgoblin fantasies and bogies. Among the sensations ascribed to spirituality were feelings of love, erotic arousal, and startling frights. You just got to do is look at these creatures. All I did has a look. I never liked them. And I'll say it a million times before I even knew about any of this stuff, that they came from mythological little things, these pooties. That's what they are, okay? And whenever they do show another angel who's a full size, it's a lot of times it's effeminate. Not all the time, I'm saying, but a lot of times they show them effeminate or they show them naked. Even big angels naked. And you'll see that too. They're inventing angels in the image of carnal man with these fornicating desires. Our angels who are watching over us to prevent us from immodesty and from pornography and from lust are looking over us, and they look like that, completely naked, floating around. Who do you think that is? That's the devil. So there's your pooty section we just gave you here. Now we're going to go to our next picture, which is some satyrs. Half man, half goat pictures. Now we're going to go to some more pictures. You're going to look at some centaur-like creatures that look like centaurs. And now we're going to see some miscellaneous naked or mythological creatures. Here we see two naked creatures and a baby. And here we see more naked mythological creatures. Now, that's the door. And I don't even know if we got everything. Now, you can do the math. Six pious pictures, and I don't know how many I mentioned over here, overwhelming and surrounding it. What, for the love of the Catholic God and the Catholic faith, does this have to do on the door in God's home, mixed with on top of it, mixed with Jesus and Mary and St. Peter and St. Paul? I wish that all you had on that door was mythological false gods and idols, and don't pretend to be Catholic, because God don't go for it, because you scandalize the Catholic God, the Catholic name, and the Catholic faith. You prevent people from coming into our church, because they think that's what Catholics believe in. St. Paul said that to the Jews. When you commit these sins, you scandalize the true God, the God of Israel, and you prevent people from coming into the true church. This has been going on for years, folks. For years. Now, after you saw the evidence on these enemies on the gates or on the doors, does it fit this description we're going to read from Psalm 117:20? This is the gate of the Lord. The just shall enter into it. Can anybody, with an ounce of goodwill, even if they're not Catholic and know what we believe in, call those gates and doors the gate of the Lord? Instead, what do we really call it? What is it in real life? This is the gate of Satan, and the unjust shall enter into it. Or, this is the gate of idols, and the unjust shall enter into it. And indeed, anybody that enters into that place knowing about that, and they don't condemn it and denounce it and pray in the place, they're done for. They're not Catholic, they're idolaters and formal heretics. And then just two verses later down there from this psalm, it says, the stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner, Psalm 117:22. Jesus was condemning the Jews back then who were supposed to accept him, and they denied him. So what have they done with these doors? They're denying the cornerstone. They're denying the cornerstone. And one thing that's very important to note is, It's not very easy finding out what's on those doors when you read the so-called Catholic sources. A lot of them say they just have allegorical figures up there. Or they'll give you some excuse. You read the so-called Catholic Encyclopedia, the Apostate Heretical Catholic Encyclopedia on the St. Peter's Basilica, they don't talk about it at all. They completely ignore it. So they're very, in other words, they know they're acknowledging their guilt. They're hiding it. They're trying to hide it from people. So it's very hard to find these pastor had it in there. That book is from 1880s. And by the way, that was volume 5, pages, I got the pages. You'll look at my book on it. But they try to sort of hide it from you and it'll say it's an allegorical figure, or you know, they use some type of a word other than what it really is. You know, and it's not easy even on the internet to find close-up pictures of this, but we won't tell you the story how we got it. It was a miracle how we got these pictures, because it's not easy if you search around. Even the virtual tour in the Vatican, which does, by the way, shows a lot of stuff on the inside, but mostly naked and pornographic stuff, but they don't show you the door at all. They don't show you the door, the virtual thing on the Vatican. People really, really try to hide this stuff and sweep it under the carpet. But it'd be better off if it was under a carpet, but it wasn't. It was right on the door. And even if it was under the carpet, they'd have problems. Now, we're going to go and we're going to take a look at the enemies inside the gate. In the gate, inside the doors. We're going to go in to St. Peter's Basilica, and we're going to see how they desecrated also the inside of it. Now, when you first come in the entrance, you're going to see... As you see right here, naked puni surrounding papal symbols and carvings of popes. We have another picture of naked puni surrounding papal symbols and carvings of popes. And now we're going to go down the nave, and you're going to see some immodest mythological virtue creatures. And here we need to discuss what these are. And anybody who went in these places looks at it and says... You can just take a look at it and you go, well, it's not the Blessed Virgin Mary, it's not St. Anne, it's no saint. What are these things? Mythological virtue creatures are figures of females taken from mythology to represent the virtues. Catholics are forbidden to use such pagan figures to represent the virtues under pain of idolatry. Instead, Catholics must use holy women to represent the virtues, such as the Blessed Virgin Mary, Seat of Wisdom, if you want to represent virginity in all of them, or she incorporates them all. The good Saint Anne, Saint Elizabeth, Judith, Deborah, Esther. You have a whole slew of Catholic saints during the New Covenant era, and holy Jewish women saints during the Old Covenant era, and even before that, maybe in the time of Noah and all that, and you go back. You have all these women that you can use to represent the virtues, but what do? They use the mythological virtue creatures, what the mythological people use, the false gods, and they're not saints, they're not holy, and you can see right here a picture of one of them right up here. All right, that's in inside St. Peter's Basilica, and we're going to take a look now, and you'll notice that a lot of these mythological virtue creatures are on your secular non-Catholic buildings, like the Supreme Court, like courthouses and buildings. They have them all over the place. Statue of Liberty is one of them. She's a whore, really, but she's a mythological virtue creature. She's not a saint. She's nothing holy about her. Take a look over here, Riverside Courthouse in California, with some of these mythological virtue creatures on it. Now we're seeing Peace, the mythological virtue creature of representing peace, in the Royal Exchange Building in England, in these secular, pagan, non-Catholic buildings. And now we see the mythological virtue creature that represents justice, truth, and wisdom in St. George's Hall in England. And then we see the mythological virtue creature representing justice on the U.S. Senate building. And certainly all these things got nothing to do with the Catholic faith. And anybody that looks at these creatures, even in so-called Catholic places, says, what is that? The first thing that comes to your mind is a false goddess. And indeed, that's what they really are. So now we're going to go down the nave and we're going to take a look at these. First, we'll say many of these mythological virtue creatures were created by Bernini and his 41 helpers from 1599 to 1649. On this first picture, we're looking at the mythological virtue creature representing virginity, bearing a breast, completely naked breast, and that's virginity. If that's virginity, then I'd like to see what fornication is, or impure or immodesty is. Here, that's supposed to represent virginity, and she's barren and naked breast. A lot of these are showing their breasts. Now we see another picture here in the nave, the mythological virtue creature representing obedience, also bearing a breast. And then we see another mythological virtue creature representing constancy and clemency, both bearing a breast. And we see the mythological virtue creature representing patience, bearing a breast. Now we're going to go into the chapel of the choir, and we're going to see naked human, pooty plant, and genie creatures. Now we're going to talk about the genies, or the genies. Everybody knows what that word genie is, right? But I'm going to show you what that is, and you're going to see them throughout these places. We'll just give you an example of one of the genie creatures that are inside it, and we're going to describe, you can see it right here, the picture. And basically, they are adult-looking angels, but they're really devils. They're very effeminate-looking, and they're usually completely naked, and they have feminine characteristics. It's a complete blasphemy against the angels. It's sort of like an adult pooty. But I'm going to read about it. The genie is plural, and genie is singular. The genie is the plural form of genie. In the ancient Roman religion, genie creatures were viewed as protective spirits. They were usually depicted naked and almost naked and have specific duties, such as guarding tombs or doorways. The genie is a pagan and idolatrous replacement of Catholic guardian angels. And you'll notice, too, as you see these pictures, they're effeminate-looking, and it's disgusting. And they're naked, completely naked. All right, now before we go into the church again, we're going to show you one picture in the church of a plant, of these plant creatures. And really, a plant creature simply is half human and half plant. You can figure out what that is. I don't know. It ain't human, it ain't plant, it's half human, it's half plant. It's like you're watching Star Wars or Star Trek, you know, where they got these goofy-looking creatures with an artichoke coming out of their head. I mean, what is that? It's not Catholic, it's not holy, it's no creature God created, and I will tell you right now, if anybody saw something like that, be gone, Satan, and get away from me. And I don't doubt that people see things like that, like UFOs, but they're from the devil. The devil can take on the shape of a centaur, a satyr, a plant creature. What are these things doing in God's home? Half human and half plant. That's what we call plant creatures. Through here, you're also going to see, I'll cover it now, even though it's going to be in another room, what we call filigree creatures. These are creatures that are half human, half filigree. Some stupid design up to the waist, and they got this goofy-looking design coming out of them. So we call them filigree creatures, for want of another word. But there's certain nothing God ever created. All right, you're going to see those too as we go along in here. Now, we're in the chapel of the choir, and we'll mention a little bit about it. The liturgy of the hours are celebrated in this chapel. It was decorated by Maderno, Bianchi, and Borromini from 1540 to 1740. And we're going to go look at the ceiling here first. And we see decorating the ceiling, there are several naked plant creatures and naked pooty. Now we're going to look at a close-up of some of these pictures that you're looking at. Here's a close-up of the naked plant creatures with wings and two naked pooty. And here's a close-up of an immodest plant creature. Now we're going to look at the walls in this chapel. We see in this picture winged plant creatures holding a torch with a face on the base. And over here we see on this picture naked pooty and naked women decorate a scene from the Bible. And in this picture, we have a close-up of the naked pooty. And in this picture, a close-up of the naked women. And in this picture, we see naked genie creatures and naked pooty. And in this close-up, we see the naked genie creatures. And in this one, a close-up of naked pooty. Now we're going to take a look at the altar area, which has naked pooty. We're here looking at this picture here. We see the naked pooty climb vines on the Bernini columns and hold emblems above the shrine of St. Helena. Now we're going to look at a close-up of that. We see a close-up of the naked pooty above the shrine of St. Helena. And now we're going to look at a close-up of the a closer picture of the naked Pudi climbing the vines on the Bernini column. Now we're going to go into the apse, and you're going to see naked Pudi, winged naked filigree, and seashell creatures. Now, seashell creatures, for want of another word, is half human, half seashell. They usually just show their face, and it spans out into a seashell. Again, what is that? God didn't create it. It's got nothing to do with God and what he created. It's first of all, fantasy. It's false. And if anybody ever saw a shell creature face like it's from the devil appearing like that. And so that's what we call, for want of another word, shell creatures. The apse was constructed from 1666 to 1752. We're now going to take a look at the ceiling. And we see naked Pudi at the top, four naked filigree creatures across the center, and two seashell creatures at the bottom. And here's a close-up of the winged naked filigree creatures. And here's a close-up of seashell creatures. Now we're going to look at, in the apse, the altar of the chair of St. Peter. Here we're looking at naked Pudi and Bernini sculpture above the chair of St. Peter. And here we see a close-up of the naked Pudi. The whole filthy mess was made to look like an orgy, with bodies clinging together and piled on top of each other. And in this picture, another close-up of the naked Pudi. Now, after you observed all this evidence, and there's more in there, we're only just showed you some of it, of the enemies on the gates, the doors, the enemies in the gates, the inside of the St. Peter's Basilica, of all the idols, all the false gods and the false religions, but particularly we're going to concentrate now on the immodest pictures and the naked pictures, which is extreme immodesty, naked, and the pornographic pictures. They're all over the place, loaded. As soon as you walk in the place and you look, as soon as you look at the door, you're looking at nakedness. You're looking at breasts. You're looking at males' private parts. You're looking at behinds of not just little kids, but even adults. And you're not even supposed, shouldn't show even behinds of even children. But you're looking at all kinds of nakedness, all kinds of immodesty. Women completely naked, their breasts hanging out and everything. Now let's take a look at the sign, and this is going to add to their crime. This is going to prove how hypocritical they are. They're a bunch of sticking, rotten, lousy hypocrites. And it's going to prove that they got bugs in their brains. How could you have the audacity to put the sign I'm going to now show you, here it is, we're going to post it, up before you enter. And it says, it tells you that you can't enter this basilica unless you're modestly dressed, is what it comes out to. If you're looking at it, the first picture says, nobody with tank tops, nobody with shorts. You must have all your, you have some, women have to wear dresses, men have to wear pants, and women have to cover up themselves modestly. You can see that on the sign. And this modesty warning sign can even can be seen everywhere in Vatican City and is being more strictly enforced. Tourists have been even banned from entering the church due to wearing shorts or shoulder-revealing shorts. They can't even show their shoulders. So that's good. That's fine. So what happens the night they go into the church? They're looking at all the statues and pictures revealing their breasts and private parts and completely and totally immodest. How come you didn't cover up the pictures? How come you didn't cover up the statues? How come you let those things to be exposed to people who you say, they can't do it, we can do it. They can't do it, I'm going to shove it in your face. That is hypocrisy to the highest degree. You think people are stupid? Even non-Catholics are scandalized by this type of stuff. It makes the church in Rome look like the whore of Babylon, like the Protestants accuse it of. But the true Catholic Church is not a whore. She's pure and holy. That's not a true Catholic Church. Apostate Catholics are like the apostate Jews. No Protestant would deny that in the Old Testament era that the Jews were God's chosen people, but that they desecrated his temple. They desecrated his home. And they turned it into a home of idolatry, into fornication and immodesty. So the same thing happened during the New Testament era. It doesn't take away from the fact that the Catholic Church is God's one holy, pure Catholic Church in faith. But that's not a Catholic Church. They desecrated it. But my point is, you're scandalizing people and lending the truth to the lie of these Protestants. It's hypocrisy to tell people, you got to cover up, but when you walk in here, I ain't going to cover up none of these statues in God's home. Worse than, the people aren't even walking in here with the women with their breasts hanging out. Even if they had a tank top, it's pretty bad. They come very close. But you go in here, the breasts are hanging out all over the place. What kind of a liar are you? What kind of a hypocrite are you? You deserve a double death, a triple death, a quadruple death. You deserve to go, and it will happen to these apostate anti-popes and apostate cardinals and bishops that allowed these things, to the deepest pits of hell with the apostate Jews. And I think they're going even deeper, because now they're even denying Christ in the revelations of the New Testament. So how's that for hypocrisy? You cover up, but don't worry. When you go inside, I'm going to show you all kinds of this nasty stuff on these statues and on these pictures. As a matter of fact, the Vatican II Church's desecration of the Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi by placing a statue of Buddha on the altar was not as evil as the apostate Catholics' desecration of St. Peter's Basilica in 1445. The Buddha on the altar was removed at Assisi, but the many Buddhas, the many idols on the door and inside St. Peter's Basilica were put up and never taken down to this day. You tell me how it's any different. How are the pagan American Indians and the pagan South American Indians any different than what these guys have done? Oh, they complain about them. They're bringing in their false Indian chief, big feather guys. They're painting their faces. They're bringing in all their false Indian gods into the churches, and they're mixing them together. They have Santeria. They have Brujeria. They're mixing idols with the Blessed Virgin Mary and with Jesus. Look what these pagan Indians and some of these Spanish people that fell for this stuff, these Indian pagans, by mixing these holy things with these profane and idolatrous things. Look what these people are doing. It's no different than what's going on in Rome. You got the Roman false gods on there. You got the Greek false gods on there. You're mixing them on there. It's as if you saw an Indian with a totem pole on it with Jesus and Mary on it, mixed with all these false gods. You want to condemn that? You better condemn Rome. You better condemn every church in Rome that condemns this filth. And why do you think all the other people are falling away? Because they're copying off of the mother whore. That is not a Catholic church. We're going to get into that later on. When you desecrate a church like that, it becomes the home of Satan. It's a non-Catholic church. It's an idolatrous church. I'm going to give you another example, which we say common sense, about the evangelists when they first went out and started to convert the idol pagans and the idol worshippers. Let's look at St. Patrick when he went to Ireland. And he went there and he told those Irish people, for the sake of their immortal souls, because he loved them, your religions are false. Your gods are false. Put them away. Destroy them. Smash them. And become Catholic and accept the true God. We show you a clip on that right now.
Granted to us. Please! No! Please! I come in the name of the one true God. Irish people live in slavery and fear. Fear of their druids, fear of their false gods, and fear of human sacrifice. Never again will innocent Irish blood be shed upon this pagan altar. Never! Never again!
Now, imagine for 1 minute, these people, and they did. He converted a whole bunch of people in Ireland. They listened to St. Patrick. They obeyed him by the grace of God. They took their idols and smashed them, destroyed them. And then Patrick says, why don't you come to my church for Sunday Mass? And they go to St. Patrick's church, and they see on his door all the idols that they just smashed. And he just told them are false, are worthless, must be destroyed. And he goes, and they're on the door in his church, and they go in his church, and they're all over his church. What would they do? You're a hypocrite. You're a liar. You told us to get rid of them, and you have them. I'm done for. I'm not going to be Catholic. That's what would happen. He'd scandalize them. Can you even imagine St. Patrick could do such a thing? Could you imagine I would do such a thing? That somebody would visit my house? Imagine if you visit Mary's little house. And on my door, I got four nice pictures and idols. The rest of it's all idols. And mixed with naked pictures and fornicating creatures. Boy, people would love to get the stuff on me, huh? Mm-hmm. Look at Rich Ibrani. We got him. I seen his door. And if I did do that, you'd have every right to get me. But imagine that. St. Patrick goes out there and tells them to destroy them, which is God's decree from of old. And then the very idols he told them to destroy are up on his door in his church. Take a look at what's going on over there in Rome. That whore, that harlot, it's not the true Catholic Church anymore once it gets desecrated like that. We're going to read now Word God from the Old Covenant, and it's this immortal, infallible dogma about idols. We're reading Deuteronomy 12, 2-3. Destroy all the places in which the nations that you shall possess, worship their gods upon high mountains and hills and under every shady tree. Overthrow their altars, break down their statues, burn their groves with fire, and break their idols in pieces. Destroy their names out of those places. Deuteronomy 12, 2-3. What did they do when they repaganized Rome? They went out and picked up those pieces. And they got yourself some Elmer glue or Gorilla glue and glued them all together. And they put them back up again in the church to provoke God to jealousy. Let's read the commentary on that. All the monuments of idolatry must be destroyed. The very names of the idols must be abhorred and obliterated to show that they have lost possession of the country. So to put his name there means to take possession of a place. Now we read Exodus 34, 12-14. Beware, thou never join in friendship with the inhabitants of that land, which may be thy ruin, but destroy their altars, break their statues, cut down their groves. Adore not any strange god. The Lord is his name. The Lord, his name, is jealous. He is a jealous God. Exodus 34, 12-14. Commentary. Now, we're reading here about the beginning of the church. No sooner... The commentary, this is a commentary on 1 Kings 5:3. No sooner was the gospel preached than the power of the idols began to decrease. So the minute Catholicism started spreading countries, idols started to decrease. Then when they came to power in the state, as secular state, the civil state, they started to destroy the idols and ban them in public worship. You cannot even put them up in public anymore. The Pantheon was a place of all false gods. The Pantheon. And all of a sudden, when the church took it over, they knocked out all the false... No, Pantheon. They knocked out all the false gods. Broke them down. Not one pagan thing was left in there. We read about it here. The Pantheon is a building in Rome commissioned by Marcus Agrippa in 27 BC and rebuilt by Emperor Hadrian in circa 126 AD. Its name Pantheon is Latin for a temple consecrated to all gods. It originally housed shrines to all the false gods of Rome, to name a few, Jupiter, Juno, Mars, Mercury, and Venus. In May of 609, the Byzantine Emperor Phocas gave the building as a gift to Boniface IV. Pope Boniface ordered all the pagan filth to be removed and that the building should be turned into a Catholic church dedicated to the Virgin Mary and all the martyrs. Here's a quote from the chronicler John Deacon of Venice. Pope Boniface asked Emperor Phocas in Constantinople to order that in the old temple called the Pantheon, after the pagan filth was removed, a church should be made to the Holy Virgin and all the martyrs so that the commemoration of the saints would take place henceforth where not gods but demons were formerly worshipped. End quote. It's called the Church of St. Mary and the Martyrs. So now what did they do? They said, well, we're going to resurrect these idols and put them back on the church door, but we will not. We'll still leave some Jesus and Mary, and we'll leave some of the saints in there side by side with them, which is what that pagan Roman emperor wanted to do when he wanted to put Jesus in there. They think they could, what is the purpose of this other than the fact that these people were enamored with it? Our Lord says in Matthew 6:21, where thy heart is, there is thy treasure also. Your heart is with mythological creatures. Because I tell you right now, pal, you can't believe in a Catholic God. You can't really believe him. You can't really fear him. You can't really know him and do what you did on that door. No, sir. Because if you know him like I know him, I'd be trembling my boots if I put anything up there that didn't even look like an idol. That God might strike me dead and send me to hell. That shows you how faithless these bastards were. We're going to give you an example of from the Roman martyrology. But first we're going to also quote from the Bible how when you had a true saint, a holy saint, many times they would smash idols. They would pass by idols and they would fall down and crash to the ground. God again, through his saints, showing his will that he abominates idols. And we even have an example in the Old Testament here, 1 Kings 5:1-4, about Dagon, who, when the Ark of the Covenant was put before the false god of the Philistines of Dagon, the idol fell down and was smashed. The Philistines took the Ark of God and carried it from the Stone of Help into Azotus. And the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the temple of Dagon and set it by Dagon. And when the Azotians arose early the next day, behold, Dagon lay upon his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And they took Dagon and set him again in his place. And the next day again, when they arose in the morning, they found Dagon laying upon his face on the earth before the Ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both palms of his hands were cut off upon the threshold. That's when you at least had some faithful Jews that God gave them that type of protection. That just goes to show you how faithless the people were in Rome. If you had any really true, tremendously holy saints, I'm not saying there might have been one or two somewhere around here, but if you did, they would walk in, that door would fall down if there were enough of them. Sometimes God, when God wants them to wallow in their crap, he wants them to stay under the Romans one curse, he wants them to progress in their apostasy. I'm not saying that every you could have had a true saint that passed the door and one have fell down, but you're seeing God's. His will is for this. Rip the door down. Rip the idols off. Destroy them. Tear them down. God could do it himself even if he wanted, but he's allowing this to happen because it's part of the great apostasy. You needed this great apostasy to come to the point where we are today to get the Antichrist in power. To give the true God a bad name. And that's why I tell you, every apostate anti-pope that was in that place and did not, I don't care if he even said, I don't like it, but I don't prefer it. It was just something like that. Didn't say, I will not go in that place. I will not conduct religious services in that place. I will not pray in that place. Unless you tear down every idol, every naked picture, and every other type of obscenity in this place. If he didn't do that, he's an apostate anti-pope. We're going to get into that later on. Now we're going to read some of the saints from the Roman Martyrology, June 27th. At Caesarea in Palestine in the persecution of Diocletian under the governor Urban, St. Anicetus, martyr, for having exhorted others to suffer martyrdom and having overthrown idols by his prayers, he was scourged by 10 soldiers, had his hands and feet cut off, and murdered the crown of martyrdom by beheading. Just by his mere prayers, because he was so holy, and God saw fit to give him that grace, the idols fell. July 16th in Campania, St. Dominica, virgin and martyr, in the time of Emperor Diocletian, for having destroyed idols, she was condemned to the beasts, But being left injured by them, she was beheaded and departed to heaven. She was beheaded and departed for heaven. Her body is kept with great veneration in Tropea and Calabria. Destroy the idols. What would these martyrs think if they... And what would these martyrs think if they came back today and you brought them over and said, this is God's home? No way. No, I ain't going in that place. No, they're apostates. They're idolaters. This is the stuff I died fighting against. This is the stuff I died despised and abhorred and hated with a perfect hatred when I was alive, as was my duty as a Catholic in order to save my soul. July 24th, at Tiro in Tuscany, on Lake Bolsena, St. Christina, Virgin and Martyr. Because she believed in Christ and broke up her father's gold and silver idols to give them to the poor, she melted it down, she broke them up. She was cruelly scourged at his command, subjected to other most severe torments, and thrown with the heavy stone into the lake from which she was drawn out by an angel. And this, by the way, this also tells these martyrs, you have to be willing to die rather than to give in. So if any apostate antipope came along and said, I was afraid, if I tried to do that, they'd kill me. They would kill me. Oh, I don't want to die. You faggots. You effeminate, unfaithful bastards. You got to be ready to die for Christ. And I tell you, the reason why you have a lot of these people that are apostates, because they are non-judgmentalists, non-punishmentalists. They're effeminate. They love the world more than God, and they're afraid of dying. They love the world more than God. They don't really believe in God. You can't believe in God. Righteous, loving God, the way we're supposed to love God, gets you so angry when you look at stuff like that. You're going to denounce and condemn everybody that supported it, everybody that defended it, everybody that favored it, and everybody that had the power to do something about it and didn't do nothing about it. Now we read on September 15th at Marcianopolis in Thrace, St. Militina, a martyr in the time of Emperor Antoninus and the governor Antiochus. She was twice led to the temples of the heathens. St. Peter says, what a shame. And since the idols fell to the ground each time, she was hanged and torn and finally beheaded. Boy, the pagan artists would have hated these martyrs. They would have put them out of business. Imagine every time they passed by the guy making Michelangelo, one of these bums making these idols, they would all fall and crash down. They say, it's like when the Jews try to rebuild the temple and God goes, this.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is, what a difference of spirit we're talking about here. December 26th, at Rome, St. Marinus, a man of senatorial rank in the time of Emperor Numerian and the perfect Marcian, he was arrested for the Christian religion, racked and torn with iron claws like a slave, then thrown into the burning cauldron. Oh, I don't want that to happen to me. That's what they're afraid of. But being delivered, because the fire became like a dew, he was exposed to the beast without being injured by them, and finally being led to the altar, the idols of which toppled over at his prayer, he was struck with the sword and thus obtained the triumph of the martyrs. There you have an example of God's will, that we must hate idols, we must despise them, and we must destroy them. When Abram, also known as Abraham, was in Ur of the Chaldees, he and his family worshipped idols, false gods. But by God's grace and his goodwill cooperation, Abram eventually rejected the idols and false gods and sought the true God with his whole heart. He smashed and destroyed the idols of his family. Hence, God enlightened Abram so that he eventually found the true God in the true faith.
Come inside, Abram. Something I want to show you.
It's rather impressive, don't you think? Here's a divinity with a hidden power. Huh? Herbs of some kind. Not sure exactly which. Tastes awful, but it's blessed by this deity, which gives it amazing potency.
Is this why you've asked me here?
Well, yes, I thought...
Just to show you.
Abram, tonight, try a little of this. Sarai, too. Rumour I tried it, and I can't tell you the...
God's for this, God's for that, a God
to eat! Abram, what are you doing?
A God to sleep!
Are you insane?
God's
Stop
for
it.
Riches!
Stop it!
That's for rain, you madman! They're all worthless, false, useless!
Stop it!
Absurd! Lies! Lies! Lies!
No! 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 Stop this madness now!
Now we're going to read in Daniel 11:31 when the Jews' temple was desecrated by an image of Jupiter, a mythological god. Daniel 11:31. The commentary tells you this, but we'll read it. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall defile the sanctuary of strength, and they shall take away the continual sacrifice, and they shall place there the abomination unto desolation. This is going to happen also with the Antichrist, but this happened back then also. This is a Catholic commentary on that verse. The idol of Jupiter, Olympus, which Antiochus, during the time of the Maccabees, ordered to be set up in the sanctuary of the temple, which is here called the sanctuary of strength from the Almighty that was worshipped there. Other idols were set up, and the people were compelled to sacrifice. Yet even the hottest persecutions, some remained faithful. Antiochus represented the Antichrist. What did he do? He set up an idol, Jupiter, in the temple of God. Every apostate antipope that set up those idols on those doors that didn't denounce them or didn't like them but didn't condemn them and rip them off the doors is an antichrist. An antichrist. An Antiochus. Another Antiochus. One after another. Who allowed that abomination, not even allowed, they commissioned it. Supported it. Favored it. And you're going to see even the ones that didn't favor it still allowed it because they didn't condemn it for what it was. Now we're going to read about how Judas Maccabeus, when that Jupiter Olympus idol was up in the temple of God, how he reacted to having an idol up in the temple of God. Did he sit back and say, hey, this is swell, I like it, that's neat? Or did he just simply, was he indifferent? He says, well, I don't like it, I don't hate it, but who cares, it's up there. Or, I don't like it, but let's not denounce it, let's not condemn it. What did he do? We're going to read. Now, this that was what he did in the temple, and we're going to read what his... When they went and they purified the temple, by the way, they did. They tore it down and everything, and they destroyed all these idols. And they even destroyed the altar and rebuilt a new altar because they didn't want to even rebuild on the altar that was desecrated. But we're going to read what he did when they brought idols into the area of Modin. And they had your apostate priest that went over to these idols, and he went over to Antiochus Epiphanes in 1 Maccabees 2, 12 to 14. And behold, our sanctuary and our beauty and our glory is laid waste, and the Gentiles have defiled them. To what end, then, should we live any longer? It bothered him so much, he wanted to even die. That's the way we look at this stuff. This stuff almost kills you when you look at it. It's so bad. He says, why should we live any longer? And Mattathias and his sons rent their garments. That was the father of Judas Maccabeus. And they covered themselves with haircloth and made great lamentation. Now, as he left off speaking these words, there came a certain Jew in the sight of all to sacrifice to the idols upon the altar in the city of Modin, according to the king's commandments. And Mattathias saw and was grieved, and his reins trembled, and his wrath was kindled according to the judgment of the law. And running upon him, he slew him upon the altar. Moreover, the man whom King Antiochus had sent, who compelled them to sacrifice, he slew at the same time and pulled down the altar and showed zeal for the law of God, as Phinehas did by Zimri, the son of Salami. And Mattathias cried out in the city with a loud voice, saying, everyone that has zeal for the law and maintaineth the testament, let him follow me. So he and his sons fled into the mountains and left all that they had in the city. So that was his reaction to them bringing idols into his local church in Modin. On his altar. That's what he did. He went and he killed the priest that consented to and smashed up the altar and then went out into the mountains. And then later on, as we read the history of Maccabees, his son Judas Maccabees finally was able to conquer and beat back Antiochus and get into Jerusalem and take back the temple, and then he purified it. We read about how he's discussing what should we do with the altar that was defiled. He says, let's just destroy the altar and rebuild a new one because it's already been defiled by these idols. And this is 1 Maccabees 4:44 to 48. And he considered about the altar of holocaust that had been profaned, what he should do with it. And a good counsel came into their minds to pull it down, lest it should be a reproach to them, because the Gentiles have defiled it. So they threw it down, and they laid up the stones in the mountain of the temple in a convenient place. till there should come a prophet and give answer concerning them. Then they took whole stones according to the law and built a new altar according to the former. And they built up the holy places and the things that were within the temple, and they sanctified the temple and the courts. So that's his reaction to what you do to something. He already got the idols out of there, destroyed all of them. That would be like somebody going to the Vatican and say, first of all, you don't even say, what do we do with the idols? We smash them, we destroy them, we get rid of them. Now what do you do with the altar that the idols are on? And because when the people come in here, their impression is they remember what was on here. Tear down the altars in there. Maybe, possibly, tear down the whole building and build a new one. Or at least, at best, rip down the altars and sandblast the walls and everything. That's what Judas Maccabees does. And let's listen to the holy prophet Jeremiah. In the days he lived, the Jews desecrated their temple with idols and the king's palace with idols. They were committing all kinds of sins of immorality. We read in Jeremiah 32:34, and they have set their idols in the house in which my name is called upon to defile it. And Jeremiah 2:11, my people have changed their glory into an idol. And Jeremiah 8:18, why then have they provoked me to wrath by their idols and strange vanities? And in Jeremiah 16:18, and I will repay first their double iniquities and their sins, because they have defiled my land with the carcasses of their idols, and they have filled my inheritance with their abominations. And this is one of the reasons that the main reasons why God destroyed the temple eventually, allowed King Nebuchadnezzar to come in and destroy the temple. We are now going to go to the clip and show you how he's condemned the idols that were prevalent in Jerusalem, in the temple, and in the king's palace at that time.
You trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense the Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house which is called by my name and say, we are delivered, only to go on committing all these abominations? Behold, I myself have seen it, says the Lord. He has prophesied.
I have granted you this audience, but it'll be your last. What is of such importance that you risk your life to see me?
Obey, I beseech thee, the voice of the Lord which I speak unto thee, and your life will be saved, and the city will not be burned.
So now you're speaking for the Lord again. Well, never mind, our armies are prepared.
How can you continue to lie to yourself as well as your people?
Truth is in the eye of the beholder.
The word of the Lord which I speak to thee is the truth.
The word of the Lord which you ask me to seek is science! If God has something to say to me, why does he send you to tell me?
Why would the Lord speak to you unless you've committed your life to him?
I have. Instead of erecting monuments to false gods,
make your life a living monument to the word of God.
It is as my people desire.
You are king. They look to you for leadership. Your pursuit of your own pleasure, wealth, and power have taught the people to trust in false gods. You have led them to believe that the one true God is not enough. You have destroyed the kingdom God has promised.
God will attend to you for your evil.
Now, we're going to read from the prophet Osi. Israel has cast off the thing that is good. The enemy shall pursue him. They have reigned, but not by me. They have been princes, and I knew not. Of their silver and their gold, they have made idols to themselves that they might perish. Osi 8, 3 to 5 to 4. And now, he goes on to say, because you've done these things, I will not hear your prayers or your holocaust. I will not accept your holocaust. I will not accept all your holy masses that you've been saying ever since you apostatized. Your masses are worthless. Not only are they worthless, they're sacrilegious. They're bringing down multiple curses upon your head for abusing the holy sacrifice of the mass. Look what he says. They shall offer victims, masses, and they shall sacrifice flesh, the Holy Eucharist, and shall eat it, the Holy Eucharist, and the Lord will not receive them. Now will he remember their iniquity, and he will visit their sins, and they shall return to Egypt. And so they already have returned full scale. Now we read here, OC also, chapter 9, verse 8 to 9. The watchman of Ephraim was with God. The prophet has become a snare and a ruin unto his ways. The apostate antipopes and the apostate cardinals. Madness is in the house of God. They have sinned deeply, as in the days of Gaba. He will return their iniquity and he will visit their sin. Madness, not just with the idols and immorality and pedophilia and fornications, in theology mostly of important of all against the faith. The stuff I've been dealing with for now 10 years, I've been exposing their buffooneries, their foolishness. I always say it about these apostate antipopes and all these heretics going back for 700, 800 years. They got bugs in their brains. Bugs in their brains. They say stupid things. They say illogical things that a 7-year-old could pick out even. I've already documented a lot. We're going to document more of it. And then we're going to bury them and go on with the way the true Catholic faith and the true Catholic Church. Now look, we're going to go on and read what happened here when, in the time of Joshua, of course we know it, the Jews were mixing idols with the true God. Joshua 24, 14 to 15. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve Him with a perfect and most sincere heart. And put away the gods which your fathers served in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if it seem evil to you to serve the Lord, you have your choice. Choose this day that which pleaseth you, whom you would rather serve, whether the gods which your fathers served in Mesopotamia, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And he's telling them, in so many words, don't pretend to do both. Do one or the other. If you're going to do this, you better get over here and do that. Don't think you can worship the true God while you're also idolizing. Even if you said you didn't believe in these idols, but you were enamored by them, you loved them, you glorified them, which is happening in these churches. They're up in prominent places. They're in a positive light. Now we read about the prophet Samuel in 1 Kings 7:3. And Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you turn to the Lord with all your heart, put away the strange gods among you, Balaam and Ashtaroth, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve Him only, and He will deliver you out of the hands of the Philistines. This is from the holy prophet Samuel. What did they do? They went and got the false gods and put them back in. Prophet Sophonias, chapter 1, verse 4 to 5. And I will stretch out my hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will destroy out of this place the remnant of Baal and the names of the wardens of the temples with the priests, and then that worship the host of heaven upon the tops of houses, and then that adore and swear by the Lord and swear by Malcolm. They're trying to do both, you see. Sophonias 1:4-5. The Catholic commentary is Malcolm, the idol of the Ammonites. Those who join idols with God do not worship Him indeed. God will not allow His glory to be given to another. Such lame worship or divided heart, He rejects. See 3 Kings 18:21. And we all know that one. That's Elias, is when he confronted the false prophets of Baal. We're going to discuss that right now. The other commentary on this one verse was, whoever joins false gods with God Almighty indeed serveth not God at all. The prophet Elias, 3 Kings 18:21. And Elias coming to all the people said, "How long do you halt between two sides? If the Lord be God, follow him. If thou, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. If Zeus is the true God, then take off Jesus, Mary, and St. Paul and keep Zeus up there. If you believe Jesus is the true God, get rid of Zeus, get rid of Mercury, get rid of all these false gods on the store and in all your churches and purify the filth out of them. You cannot have it both ways. Prophet Ezekiel chapter 20. "And as for you, O house of Israel, thus saith the Lord God, walk ye everyone after your idols and serve them. But if in this also you hear not, but defile my holy name anymore with your gifts and with your idols." He's not telling them. He's saying, go with your idols now, but don't go with the true God. We're going to give you the commentary. That's what he's saying. I'm sick and tired of you. You can't do both. Go to your idols. Here's the Catholic commentary. "Walk ye everyone after your idols. It is not an allowance, much less a commandment to serve idols, but a figure of speech by which God would have them to understand that if they would walk after their idols, they must not pretend to serve him at the same time, for that he would by no means suffer such a mixture of worship." St. Jerome teaches that. "God would rather have idolaters leave him holy than halt between the two," 3 Kings 18, "neither hot nor cold, for such dishonors God's name the most." They're more evil than the full-blown pagans. Let's read what the great St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, 20-21. "But the things which the heathens sacrifice, they sacrifice unto devils and not unto God. And I would not have you be partakers with devils. You cannot drink the chalice of the Lord and the chalice of devils. You cannot partake at the table of the Lord and the table of devils." And there again, St. Paul said, you cannot mix these two things. He says also, St. Paul, 2 Corinthians 6, 14-17, "Bear not the yoke of unbelievers. For what participation hath justice with injustice? Or what fellowship hath light with darkness? Or what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath the faithful with the unbeliever? And what agreement hath the temple of God with that of idols? For you are of idols. Wherefore, go out from amongst them and be ye separate, saith the Lord." But no, they mix them together. They touch them. They embrace them. They glorify them. They love them. They really loved them more than the true God, but they knew they couldn't get away with it so bad as they had to put a few holy pictures up there. They pretended, though, some of them, that they can do both. But then you're not really worshiping the Catholic God at all. This is just another false God amongst your pantheons of gods. Even St. Paul said in Titus 1:16, "They profess to know God, but in their works they deny him, being abominable and credulous into every good work reprobate." I believe in Jesus Christ, but look at that door. No, you don't. That's not the true Jesus Christ. You got him surrounded by all these idols that you like, that you love. Think of all the stuff they could have put up on that door. All the stories, all the saints, all the true saints, all the martyrdoms, all the conversions. Yeah, one thing we didn't mention, and it's on the door, is they have heads of pagan emperors. Pagan Roman emperors. The Jews went nuts when they tried to put up the pagan Roman picture symbol up in the temple. They went crazy and revolted. Just one picture of one of the pagan Roman governors they were going to put up in the temple. They got pagan Roman emperors up all over this door also, by the way, folks. Not holy Roman emperors, not Catholic kings that are saints. What is this? The whole door is that. There's nothing else holy in it but with these six panels we showed you. And even in one of those six panels, as you can see, the one with St. Paul here, they got the two head Janus in there also. So, as we said, these are non-Catholic churches. In no way will God ever support this behavior. He abandons them. He removes himself. In the beginning, he was punishing them a little bit to try to get their attention with massive punishments. If you read about the punishments, God struck them with the Black Plague, with the floods, to try to get their attention, and they didn't listen. So they let them go hog wild. Then he just backed off on them and let them prosper with a false prosperity, because it's necessary to bring the false prophet and the Antichrist to power. But it doesn't mean that God approves it. He's getting ready to give them the big shot. But these churches, once they're desecrated notoriously, like you're looking here at St. Peter's Basilica, are non-Catholic churches. So-called Catholic churches and other holy places that are notoriously desecrated with idols, false gods, false religions, immodesty, or pornography are non-Catholic churches and places. To commit a sin of immodesty or fornication is a mortal sin of immorality. But it is also a sin of former heresy for those who believe that immodesty or fornication, which is represented in pornography, is acceptable or not sinful. And when you put it up on the church and you put it in prominent public places, you're saying to the people, this is not sinful. It's one thing to commit adultery and to go to the priest and confess it. It's another thing to say, adultery is not sinful at all. I don't got to confess it. Now that's heresy. Now, by publicly posting up idols and immodesty and pornography is telling everybody you think it is acceptable or it's not sinful and it's acceptable. So when you put it up like that, if you were to ask any one of these apostate antipopes that allow these things up there to say, do you think this is okay and acceptable and it's not sinful? He'd say, of course, that's why I'm doing it. If I thought it was sinful or unacceptable, I'd take it off. I rip it off. Now, that's another. Usually people, when they're committing sins that they know are sins, they're sneaky about it. They have their dirty pictures in their rooms. They hide them under their bed. Sometimes they'll put them on their wall in their room, but they're not going outside and broadcasting it because they know it's sinful. All you got to do is ask the person, do you think that these pictures are not mortally sinful and immoral? And if they said no, or if even they said, I think it's sinful, but in this case it's acceptable, they're out too. They are then formal heretics. So sins of immorality can also become sins of former heresy. This is taught from the beginning of the church even. It's one thing to practice usury. It's another thing to say that usury is okay. And there's nothing wrong with it. So that's when sins of immorality then become also former heresy. A homosexual who says, I know it's wrong. But what happens when the guy comes out and says, I think God created us this way and it's not wrong? He's a heretic, you see? Now, you can see I'm going to write a book on that. It's not up. I haven't done it yet. It's an important topic. I'm not sure about the title, but it's going to be something like The Doubt or Denial of a Moral Dogma is Formal Heresy. Okay, now, we're looking at these churches. They're desecrated with idols, false gods, false religions, immodesty, pornography, and they're non-Catholic churches. I am now going to speak about the culpability regarding desecrations. 1. Catholics who are guilty of the mortal sin of heresy or idolatry are formal heretics or idolaters and thus are not Catholic. 2. So-called Catholics who support or allow desecrations against the faith are guilty of the mortal sin of heresy or idolatry and thus are not Catholic. 3. So-called Catholics who support or allow desecrations against morals are guilty of the mortal sin of immorality, and if these desecrations are notorious, then they are also guilty of the mortal sin of heresy, and thus are not Catholic. 4. So-called Catholics who do not condemn immoral, heretical, or idolatrous desecrations as immoral, heresy, or idolatry are guilty of a mortal sin of omission and a mortal sin of immorality, heresy, or idolatry. 5. So-called Catholics who do not denounce those who support or allow immoral, heretical, or idolatrous desecrations as immoral, heretics, or idolaters are guilty of a mortal sin of omission and a mortal sin of immorality, heresy, or idolatry. 6. So-called Catholics who are knowingly in religious communion with those who support or allow desecrations against the faith are guilty of a mortal sin of heresy or idolatry and thus are not Catholic. 7. So-called Catholics who are knowingly in religious communion with those who support or allow notorious desecrations against morals and know the deeper dogma that these desecrations are heretical are guilty of the mortal sin of heresy and thus are not Catholic. 8. Places notoriously desecrated with images against the faith or morals are non-Catholic places. Hence, a church notoriously desecrated with images against the faith or morals is a non-Catholic church. For more information, see RGMI book, The Desecration of Catholic Places, The Effects of Desecrations. 9. So-called Catholics, infants included, who belong to a church notoriously desecrated with images against the faith or morals, are outside the Catholic Church and thus not Catholic, because they adhere to a non-Catholic church. 10. So-called Catholics who visit desecrated places and know about the desecrations, but nevertheless attend religious services in these places, are guilty of a mortal sin of heresy or idolatry if the desecrations are against the faith. Or they are guilty of a mortal sin of immorality if the desecrations are against morals, and if the immoral desecrations are notorious, and they know the deeper dogma that these desecrations are heretical, then they are also guilty of the mortal sin of heresy, and thus are not Catholic. 11. It is a deeper dogma that non-Catholics are banned from holding offices in the Catholic Church. Hence, all who support or allow any kind of desecration against the faith or notorious desecrations against morals are banned from holding offices. If they have an office, they automatically lose it. If they are candidates for offices, they cannot validly obtain the offices. Catholics who know or should know this deeper dogma must denounce these offenders as non-office holders under pain of the mortal sin of heresy. 12. It is a deeper dogma that non-Catholics must not be included in the Te Igitur prayer of the Mass. 13. Catholics who are inculpably ignorant of the deeper dogmas that non-Catholics are banned from holding offices and that non-Catholics must not be included in the Te Igitur prayer of the Mass and thus include a so-called office holder who they know is not Catholic are only material heretics. But they must nevertheless denounce him as a non-Catholic heretic or idolater and not be in religious communion with him. In the Te Igitur prayer, Catholics pray for, not with, the people mentioned in it. Hence, the Te Igitur prayer is not an act of religious communion with those mentioned in it. It is an act of governmental communion and church communion. But in this case, the Catholics do not intend to include the non-Catholic putative office holder in the part of the Te Igitur prayer for all Orthodox believers because they know they are not in church communion with him because they know he is not Catholic. Hence, they only intend to include him in the part of the prayer for the office holders and thus only intend to be in governmental communion with him because they believe he holds the office. For an in-depth teaching on this topic, see RJMI book Ban on Holding Offices on Praying for Non-Catholic Putative Office Holders in the Te Igitur prayer of the Mass. So the very basic thing you need to know, that's a basic dogma. Anybody who called himself a pope that's in a church like that, allowing that and conducting services and not denouncing and removing it, you have to call him an idolater and a former heretic, and you can't be in religious communion with him, and you can't include him in the Una Cum prayer, and you can't pray with him. Now, if you don't have the deeper dogma, and this is the deeper dogma, that these guys are banned from office because all former heretics and idolaters are banned from office automatically. So these guys aren't even popes. Some of you'll see of the saints and the people back then knew, and they even denounced some of these guys as being not, how could you be a pope allowing this? Indeed, they're not popes, but you might not have that deeper dogma. But the basic dogma tells me this. You're an idolater. I'm not going to pray with you. I'm going to denounce you. And I'm going to warn other people about you. I want nothing to do religiously with you at all until you get rid of those idols, abjure from them, and so forth and so on. All right? There's the guilt. We read about the obligation of denouncing idols in the Roman Martyrology, some of the great martyrs that carried out that Catholic obligation on May 28th. At Silistria in Bulgaria during the reign of Emperor Alexander, the martyrdom of Blessed Julius, a veteran soldier in retirement, who was arrested by the officials and presented to the governor Maximus, having denounced the idols in his presence and confessed the name of Christ with utmost constancy, he was condemned to capital punishment. October 9th in Antioch, St. Publia, Abbess, when Julian the Apostate was passing by, she and her religious sang the words of David, "The idols of the Gentiles are silver and gold, and let them not make them become like unto them." By that command of the emperor, she was struck on the face and severely rebuked. That's what needs to be told to every so-called cardinal. He's not a true cardinal. He's an apostate cardinal. Every so-called pope that allowed it and supported or allowed it is not a true pope. He's an apostate anti-pope. But the very basic you got to condemn these guys of is idolaters and former heretics. And you got to avoid them in any kind of religious communion at all. Now, after you're looking at all this evidence, one may say, okay, Richard, it is bad. I agree. But you know, a lot of things since Vatican II have been bad, and surely this must be a recent thing. This must be something one of those Vatican II apostate anti-popes did, because we all agree, or at least a lot of us agree, more and more agreeing now, that all the Vatican II so-called popes are really apostate anti-popes, because they do this kind of stuff. So, is that when the door was built? Is that when these desecrations happened? Uh-uh. Well, when? 100 years before that? Could not be, when we had all these holy popes. The holy popes. I already showed you they're not holy. Got to go back further than that. And we're going to tell you when that door was put up there, and who authorized it, and who commissioned it. We got to go back to 1445. All right? Go back and you can look who was the so-called pope at that time. Apostate anti-pope Eugene IV. It was right near the end of the Western Schism. Apostate anti-pope Martin V was the first one, that so-called true pope, and he wasn't. And we'll get into that. That's our next sermon, is going to be apostate anti-popes. He wasn't the pope. And they were coming off of this schism. And Rome was desolate and needed to be rebuilt. Apostate anti-pope Eugene IV was in Florence, palsy-wowsying around with the Medicis, those evil, one of the most evil families that ever lived. Like the Rothschilds of today, the Medicis were completely, thoroughly diabolical. They were the moving financial support behind all this stuff we're talking about. He was friends with them in Florence for 10 years before he prepared to go back to Rome. And he was planning to, he was rebuilding St. Peter's Basilica. And he said, let's put a door on there, a bronze door on there. And he hired an artist called Filarte, and he had him put the door on there. So he's the one who commissioned it. He's the one who approved it. And after the door was up, he was living still about 2 or 3 years and praying in the place. Loved it. He was a humanist too. We're going to get into that. He had a lot of Renaissance people around him. What we call the people that idolized mythology, idolized human beings, and really at heart hated the true God, even though they pretended to be Catholic. We're going to read about this.
His picture's even on the door.
His picture's even on the door?
Yeah, he's on the door.
He's got his picture
he's
on the
Peter
door.
He's got Peter giving him the key.
Here's the picture. Here's his picture. While I read this. And this is from the History of the Popes by Dr. Ludwig Pasteur, 1898. Apostate anti-pope Leo XIII approved this, his writings and all this. They're all apostates. This guy's an apostate too, by the way, folks, but he's got some good information in here. We have already spoken of the influence which his prolonged sojourn in Florence, the center of the Renaissance, exercised on Eugenius IV. But to complete the picture of his life, we must again return to the subject. In Florence, Eugenius saw the first gate, another word for the gate is door, made by Ghiberti for the baptistry. And it seems most probable that the sight of this masterpiece suggested to him the idea of ordering a similar work for the principal church in Rome. Accordingly, Florentine architect Antonio Orlino, surnamed Filarte, was commissioned to make a new bronze gates for St. Peter's. They were put up on the 26th of June, 1445, those same gates you're looking at there, that's it, they haven't changed. I thank God he left it up there for all these people to see how bad they are for all these years, and still adorn the central entrance. Although their workmanship cannot bear comparison with that of Ghiberti, they are worthy of notice as clearly exhibited that evil influence of the Renaissance on which we shall hereafter have to speak. In his work, which was destined for the principal entrance of the noblest church in the world, Filarte had to use the mildest terms, the bad taste, to place together with the figure of our Savior and His Virgin Mother and the princes and the apostles, and amid representations of the great religious acts of Eugenius the Pontificate, not only busts of the Roman emperors, but also forms of Mars, Roma, of Jupiter, of Ganymede, Hero and Leander, of a centaur leading a nymph through the sea, and of Leda and the swan. The composition is in keeping with the contemporary poems of humanists, whose names of Christian saints and of heathen gods are promiscuously intermingled. And pastor here says, bad taste. Okay, and I read his stuff. He never condemns her for what it is. It's idolatry. It's formal heresy. It's an abomination. And he's complimenting the guy who put it up there, and the Eugenius IV, instead of condemning the bum as an idolater. It's sort of like when they say kissing the crayon is just scandalous. Or it really, he shouldn't have done it. It's more than scandalous. Why is it scandalous? Because it's a blasphemy. Because it's idolatrous. It's an act of apostasy when you kiss the Quran. It's the same thing they do with this door. But when I first read this, I couldn't believe it. I said, we're back to 1445 with this door. I thank God for it because a picture is worth 1,000 words. All these years I've been calling out these bums. I got a whole list of all the different heresies. I'm going to give you a list of it right here. You're going to hear it. Now we're going to go into the list of heresies that we've been seeing entering in and creeping in from the time Scholasticism started to take root in the 1100s forward. And it was one progression after another, one heresy after another. And I'm only going to give you some of them here. There was a lot, and there's a lot even here, but there's even more. In my book, The Crimes and Punishments of the Great Apostasy, will have a complete list of these. The heresy of Scholasticism. The heresy that infants who die with original sin are happy and united to God. The heresy that those who die with the sole guilt of original sin go to an eternal third place other than heaven or hell. The heresy that the Pope is not infallible. The heresy that denies papal supremacy, which includes the conciliarist heresy. Canons for fighting over this in the 1300s and the 1400s should never have been allowed. It's heresy. The heresy that denies monarchic governments, which are ordained by God and the natural law by replacing them for republics and democracies. Back in the time of the 1300s, 1400s, you had people come out teaching about democracies. Italy had democracies and republics, and they weren't being condemned. And they wanted it then even related to the Catholic Church and her hierarchy, turn it into a democracy or a republic, or an oligarchy. 7, the heresy that men who died unbaptized or as formal heretics or as formal schismatics or worshiping a false god, or no god, or practicing a false religion, or adhering to a non-Catholic church or religion can be saved, which is known as a salvation heresy. It's a denial of the salvation dogma. It was big time, starting in the 1500s. The heresy that men can be saved by following their own consciences, which was held by the notorious heretic Thomas More in the 16th century. You can see my book on that. 9, the heresy that few are damned. 10, the heresy that occult form of heretics are not automatically excommunicated and thus are members of the Catholic Church and Catholic. You could read that in my article on the heretics Cajetan and Bellarmine. 11, the heresy of the use of probabilism with dogmas and heresies, which came from the Scholasticism. They were technically saying that you don't need to hold a dogma. A dogma is just an allowable opinion. They would present the dogma and not tell you it's a dogma. Presented as an allowable opinion, which you can contradict it, or the same thing with a heresy. You can hold a heresy, and they won't call you a heretic, and they won't call it a heresy. Probabilism being used with dogmas and heresies. That's another heresy in of itself, which is an offshoot from Scholasticism. Scholasticism did the same thing when these guys are reading. They present all different opinions. They don't really tell you what they are, and let your mind grasp these heresies, or deny these dogmas, and sometimes, occasionally, they'll mention it, but not a lot of times they won't even say it's a dogma or a heresy. 12, the heresy of non-judgmentalism. 13, the heresy of non-punishmentalism. 14, the heresy that priests should counsel Catholics to commit the lesser mortal sin of fornication with unmarried women, prostitutes, rather than commit the mortal sin of adultery. That is why they allowed red light districts in so-called Catholic states where prostitutes practiced their sinful trade by the consent of the so-called Catholic prelates and civil rulers. This was, I've heard, and I believe it too, because I read it, that Alphonse even taught this. If somebody would come to confession and say, you know, I'm contemplating committing adultery with this married woman, he says, well, look, instead of doing that, why don't you go to the red light district, and go, if you really can't control yourself, and go with the whore. Go with the prostitute. She's not married. At least you don't have a double crime. They were teaching these things. And he's consigning these women as prostitutes, as a profession, to take these young girls out of homes and to go into these red light districts, and he's causing her to sin and condoning her sin. You're never allowed to do evil for what you call a good. What is the proper advice you give a guy like that? Control yourself, you sinful bastard. Live chaste. Stop fornicating. Stop abusing yourself. Stop committing prostitution. Stop committing adultery. Stop looking at dirty pictures. That's the way. That's what God demands of us all who are not married. Total chastity. Instead, you can go to the whore in the red light district. They were teaching this. Yes, they were. And that's why you got all them red light districts over there. In so-called Catholic states. If I was a Catholic king in that state, that stuff is done for. When Hitler and Mussolini came to power, he closed down every prostitution house, every one of them. Killed all the main drug deals and eliminated drugs. You call this a Catholic state that allows a red light district for young girls to go in there and to be whores and prostitutes? It's a double sin you're committing when you counsel somebody like that. And you're making a mockery out of God's grace. Which is in 2 Timothy 3, 4 to 5, or 5, it says, these men will make a mockery out of God's grace. They will turn God's grace into riotousness. As if God's grace and our faith isn't enough to keep you chaste. That was a biggie. Now, 15, the heresy that a husband could commit mortal sin, the mortal sin of sodomy with their wives. Oh, yes, yes. You'll see all the evidence on this. 16, the heresy that women do not have to resist from being raped with all their might. They actually taught you sit back and let it happen and don't resist it. That's natural law even. You don't got to be Catholic to notice. This is natural law stuff, what I've been talking here even. This idea of being raped. Any woman in her right mind with the natural law is going to resist on to death. And if she can't overcome them, then it's not her fault. But the minute you sit back and allow it to happen, you're consenting to it. 17. The heresy that Catholics can receive certain sacraments from heretics and schismatics. And this particular heresy, believe it or not, folks, was first taught by the apostate, by so-called Pope, apostate anti-Pope Pius X, who allowed Catholics in Russia to receive sacraments from Russian Orthodox schismatic priests if they can't find Catholic ones. Yes, the so-called Holy Pius X taught this. I have the evidence on it. But this was being taught well before that. I think the first time it was taught by an Holy Office decree was 1864. And then apostate anti-Pope Pius X, he was the first so-called Pope who actually allowed it. Catholics receiving sacraments from schismatics and heretics. 18, the heresy that non-Catholics such as Protestants can receive certain sacraments. This crept in the late 1800s from the evidence I have. And even after the invalid and heretical 1970 Codicana law condemned even this opinion, they still taught it after that even. And coming up with their own excuses, trying to apply some type of an epikai to this dogmatic law. Which is, here's another incompetence too. Why would a Protestant want to receive the Holy Eucharist in confession if he's a Protestant? Why? There's a lot of things in this here that's really goofy, stupid, but most of all, it's heretical. 19. Heretical prayers and hymns enter in the original Latin are either in the original Latin or in mistranslations of the original Latin. The heresy that God is literally everywhere, such as in the devil or dung. The heresy of glorifying heretics, such as Origen and Tertullian. And these are declared heretics by true popes and holy councils. They start glorifying these heretics and resurrecting them up. The apostate anti-pope Leo XIII did that. He called Origen a great and holy man. One of the greater doctors, he's praising Origen, who was condemned at 3 or 4 councils by true popes in the early days of the church. So he's coming along and counteracting these things, glorifying these notorious heretics who've been declared by name. 22, the heresy that the Old Testament elect were not as holy as Catholics, which implies the heresy that God did not give them all they needed to be perfect and holy. 23, the heresy that popes and cardinals are above the law and thus can commit certain crimes and sins and not incur the penalties that simple priests and laymen would incur for committing the same crimes and sins, which is an idolization of popes and cardinals. And they were teaching even that none of the penalties in the invalid and heretical 1970 Codicana law apply to cardinals unless they specifically mention the cardinals. So all these other crimes that you would commit that are against morals and against the faith don't apply to them and they don't get penalized. But it doesn't mention the popes. It doesn't say the popes, just the cardinals. So Canon 188.4, for instance, that talks of, which does teach the truth about anybody who publicly, it's not even public, they really, it's not the whole truth. They should say anybody who defects from the Catholic faith, who's a former heretic, is automatically loses his office. That's Canon 188.4. Now, it doesn't mention the cardinals. So they would say, okay, a cardinal could defect from the faith, he keeps his office. But here's how illogical they are, bugs in the brains. You didn't mention the pope. So that means if a pope defected, he would lose it, but the lesser cardinals under him wouldn't lose it. I got a lot of stuff like this. It's incompetent, it's stupid, it's even illogical. And first of all, you're getting them off the hook. You're putting them above the law. More importantly, even God's dogmatic laws on faith and morals. 24, the heresy that popes cannot make heretical, erroneous, or harmful laws. Of course, all these apostate anti-popes that are coming along now want to protect their own behinds. So what they're doing is they're coming out and they're saying that whatever the Pope does, he can never do anything erroneous, harmful, sinful, or heretical. And so the Pope is really impeccable, is what they're teaching. And that's not what papal infallibility is all about. Papal infallibility is that the Pope is only protected in a limited way when he teaches on faith or morals, and he declares and defines something. Other than that, outside of that type of a forum, the Pope can commit any sin any other man can commit. But they were covering themselves, so you wouldn't criticize them. That's why they put the idols up in there, and they put up the naked pictures, because a Pope, yes, so-called Pope. If a Pope did it, it's got to be okay, because a Pope can never do anything wrong. Okay, 25, the heresy that idolaters or fallen heretics are not banned from holding offices. 26, the heresy that certain, of course they don't want them to be banned neither. They want you to consider them true popes, that when you get a hold of the deeper dogma that fallen heretics are banned from holding offices, they don't want you to know about that. They don't want you to know about that. 26, the heresy that certain crimes that incurred automatic infamy no longer incur automatic infamy, such as notorious adultery, notorious heresy. It came out, it's in the invalid and heretical 1970 Code of Canon Law. Adultery and certain crimes are no longer infamous. And this is a basic dogma of the natural law. 27, the heresy that acts of religious communion with heretics or schismatics does not make the offenders heretics, but only suspected heretics. And they say, oh, if you pray with a heretic, you're only gravely suspect of heresy. No, if you pray with a heretic, you're a heretic. You share in the guilt, his guilt. If you defend an adulterer, you're an adulterer. If you pray with a heretic, you're a heretic. You're not gravely suspect, and you're a formal heretic. The implication here is that you know he's a heretic, and you're praying with him anyway. You're a formal heretic. You're not suspected of heresy. That heresy's in the 1970 Code, Canon of Law. 28, the heresy that sins of omission by not professing the Catholic faith when one is bound to does not make the offenders fallen heretics, but only suspected of heretics. Same as what we said above on that. In other words, if you don't condemn a heretic when you're supposed to, you're a heretic. If you don't condemn an adulterer when you know about it, when you're supposed to, then you're an adulterer. Not suspect. Okay, they're lessening off the penalty and they're taking away the automatic excommunication on top of it. The heresy that celebrates Easter, the resurrection of Jesus Christ on Holy Saturday instead of Easter Sunday. Some of them moved it to early Saturday night, and then they even moved it, I think, to Saturday morning or afternoon now even. At the very earliest, Easter Sunday has to be celebrated after midnight when it's Sunday. That's heresy. They've done this with the Sunday Mass too, which I have in here. The heresy that Sunday Mass can now be held on Saturday instead. You can go Saturday night and escape going on Sunday. The heresy that teachings on faith and morals by sacred congregation decrees are infallible. That's another heresy trying to bind you to these decrees. They're not infallible. 33, the heresy that all of the Pope's teachings on faith and morals are infallible. So that even when he doesn't invoke his charism of infallibility, we declare, define, and decree. They say that all those other teachings when he's just given a lecture or a sermon are ordinary magisterial dogmas. That's another heresy in itself. Ordinary magisterial dogmas are unanimous consensus to the Church Fathers on faith or morals. As the Pope doesn't have two charisms of infallibility. He doesn't need it. He has one. One is sufficient. If he wants to make something infallible, he has the power to do it. He doesn't need to have this other one. But that heresy is that whatever the Pope teaches is infallible. That's another one you hear. And again, why do they do it? So they can protect these apostate anti-popes and their heretical and idolatrous teachings and have you blindly follow the bastards. He's the Pope. He said it. The Holy Spirit must have allowed the popes to desecrate St. Peter's Basilica so it's not desecrated. You're allowed to have idols in there. You're allowed to have naked pictures there because the Pope did it. As long as the Pope does it, actually they're making the Pope like God, you see. They're committing the same thing that the fallen angels did when they followed Lucifer instead of God when Lucifer rebelled against God. Now, 34, the heresy that popes cannot make sinful or harmful laws, I think I already mentioned that. 35, the heresy of promoting, defending, or allowing psychiatry, which is straight out of hell and from the devil. Only God in his grace can cure spiritual ills. It's okay to go to a doctor for physical ills of your physical body, but not for spiritual ills. Only God in his grace takes care of that. A Catholic who does that is denying God's grace, denying God's prayers, denying God's Catholic Church, and the whole purpose that's where we go to get our spiritual well-being. Psychiatry is an abomination, as I mentioned many times, and psychologists and all this kind of stuff. All right, they promote and allow this stuff. That's where they go now when a priest has a problem, right? Pedophilia, whatever, where do they send them? To a psychiatrist. Oh, what a horrible thing this is. What are you reading? Wisdom 17? I think it goes like this. It says, hand me descriptions. Wisdom 17:8. We read, for they who promise to drive away fears and troubles from a sick soul or sick themselves of a fear worthy to be laughed at. That's these psychiatrists and psychologists. Yeah. They're kooks. They're idiots. They're dum-dums. A little kid look at that and say, that guy's strange, Mom. He's a weirdo. He's a freak. They got all kinds of problems in their life. Well, these so-called Catholic so-called popes and so-called cardinals and bishops and priests and everything, they're big on psychiatry. It's a complete repudiation of God, His faith, and His grace. And what else? 36, the heresy of promoting, defending, and allowing hypnosis. All right? And that was Pius the 12th. Apostate to Pope Pius the 12th. I don't want to, I got to go back and mention what belongs on the list. This list even is the heresy of heliocentrism taught by Galileo, which was never condemned by any of these bums. And then also by we have the heresy of evolution, which came along later on in the late 1800s and was never condemned and even allowed and promoted and taught. The heresies of heliocentrism and evolution. Now we get into this 37 here, the heresy of external, the heresy that the external profession of heresy does not make offenders formal heretics if they internally do not believe in heresy. This condemns the whole idea in the early church. All these people, most of the lapses really believed in Jesus in their heart, but they denied him so they won't get killed and tortured. They were outside the church. St. Paul says it's not enough to believe in your heart. You need to profess it by your lips to be saved and to be justified. So if you externally profess a heresy to save your own flesh and from being persecuted, that's a repudiation of the whole Catholic faith altogether. If it involves idolatry, you're an idolater. If heresy, you're a formal heretic. They're now teaching because he believes in his heart he's not really a heretic. That's another modern heresy. No, indeed, he is a heretic, and he is an idolater. And he's even worse than the other ones because he's a hypocrite on top of it. And when you do that, you're actually repudiating the whole deposit of faith and showing that you fear these people more than the true God. How does the church deal with these people? You're out. The lapses who did this under torture had to repent and convert and abjure and come back into the church. They were out of the church. And most of them believed in Jesus in their heart. They just did it to save their own behinds. And so they won't be persecuted. This is a biggie you hear about. 38, the heresy that no one can know for certain that a man is guilty of a crime or sin, no matter how notorious the crime or sin is. It's another, you can't judge his heart. All throughout the scripture it says you certainly could judge a man's heart if his sins are manifest. Some men's sins are manifest. I think that's Mark 4:22. I'm not sure on that verse. Some men's sins are manifest. The just man can read the hearts of other men. Jesus says in Luke 17:3, if thy brother sin against thee and he does penance, forgive him. So rebuke him. And if he does penance, forgive him. How can I rebuke my brother if he sinned, if I don't know what a sin is? If I don't know he's guilty of sin, that means I'm unjust for even accusing him. The act you're trying to say that nobody can ever tell if anybody ever sinned. You can see somebody raping a young boy in broad daylight, sodomizing him, and you can't say he's sinning. This is another one. All right? The heresy that no one can know for certain if an offender incurred automatic excommunication, no matter how notorious the offender's crime is, that incurs the penalty of automatic excommunication. I'm not going to try to comment. I want to go on these, and the book's going to have more detail on these things because I got a lot of them here. 40, the heresy that allows Catholic children to attend non-Catholic schools, and that's in the heretical 1917 Code of Canon Law. 41, the heresy that Catholics are no longer obliged to convert non-Catholics. 42, the heresy that tithes are no longer mandatory for Catholics to give to the church. The heresy that borrowing or loaning money at interest rates above the inflation rate is not usury. 44, the heresy that condemns non-malicious falsehoods, otherwise known as evasions, as lies, such as when St. Raphael the Archangel said he was Azariah from the tribe of Israel, Judith, when she told non-malicious falsehoods to deceive Holofernes to cut his head off. We have many examples of this. 45, the heresy that children with the use of reason under 14 years of age cannot be formal heretics or incur automatic penalties, getting all these children off the hook. That's all part of we can even add here, the heresy of the idolization of infants and children. 46, the heresy that automatic vindicandi is only incurred when you lay violent hands on the Pope, and thus not for other crimes that have previously incurred this penalty. They're protecting, again, these popes, these so-called popes, Only before, if you touch any prelay, if you commit adultery, if you commit a lot of these sins against God, if you desecrate the Holy Eucharist, you're automatic ventandi, no more. Only if you lay violent hands on the Pope. So they're protecting these bastards. Who are they really protecting? These imposters. These apostate anti-popes. They're giving them this ultimate protection. The heresy that major excommunicates can receive certain sacraments. 48. The heresy that major excommunicates can administer certain sacraments. Major excommunicates are not Catholic. They're Catholics who were Catholic. They were automatically excommunicated by a major excom. They're out. They're no longer Catholic. You can be excommunicated for acts of disobedience, not even for heresy, just heresy. 49. The heresy that occult offenders are not subject to penalties, and therefore a cult former heretic, a cult adulterer, and a cult fornicator could receive the sacraments. You can even say Mass on Sunday and receive our Lord in mortal sin. That's in the 1970, the heretical 1970 Code of Canon Law. 50, the heresy that slavery is intrinsically evil. It's not. It's ordained by God. There's a good slavery and evil slavery. 51, the heresy that war and capital punishment is intrinsically evil. Anybody who reads the Bible knows that's a big lie, let alone the history of the Catholic Church and all her just judgments on just wars and capital punishment. 52, the heresy that torture is intrinsically evil. It's not intrinsically evil, or God will be evil for torturing people in hell. 53, the heresy of allowing girls to be altar boys. 54, the heresy that in all cases an offender must null the penalty in order to incur the penalty. 55, the heresy of Americanism. And then we also have the heresy of simony. They were not only buying offices, which is simony, and makes their absolute election null and void, they were selling the sacraments by mass stipends and stall fees. These two things are thoroughly and utterly diabolical. Jesus said that when you give the sacraments freely. You do not pay for his sanctifying or actual graces that come through the sacraments. You have the means to make money. You have the means through tithes. The church is to make it mandatory that all Catholics should pay at least 10% tithe to the church. That's your way of making money. And then depend on the free will donations. But you do not sell the sacraments. I cannot express how evil this one sin is alone right here. Give me $10 for a mass. You want to get buried? How much does it cost to bury your father? $50. It's $100 to get married. We all know it. And they will all kind of do it kind of sneakily. They'd have like the deacon come in the back and say, what's the customary fee for a marriage? $100, and you'd give them the white envelope with the money in it. Mass stipends, they would try to lie about it and say, it's for the priest's upkeep. Well, then why don't you say it's for the priest's upkeep and it's not for the mass? So that means if I don't give this to him, he'll still say the mass for me? No, you got to give him the $10. Mm-hmm. Then it's for the mass. They lied. They did what the Pharisees did. They made a law to try to break God's law and made an excuse for it. They were selling the sacraments. Mass stipends and stall fees is diabolical. I don't want to go off on it too much here because I can speak about that for a whole hour. And we're going to do that once. I'm going to save a lecture for that. How dare you tell people they got to pay for sanctifying grace and for the sacraments of God? And you know when they started to do that, they started to back off from tithes. They weren't making it mandatory. They were not enforcing God's law where they were supposed to go to kings and princes and tell them that you have to have mandatory tithes to the church. You would have sufficient money for everything you needed if you took your 10% tithe from the kings, from the Catholics, and from all the Catholics were supposed to pay you the 10% tithe, and then you would have got free will donations. God would have inspired people. When you start, and they're saying priests have to live off these, that's the way they have to live, they had to sell their masses. Stuff was going on like they were saying 8, 10 masses a day in the church, like shotgun masses, just to make the money. I'll have to stop here on that, but that's what was going on too. This is just a few of the things that they've done that are just completely incompetent, illogical, and stupid. One is, if you read through the liturgies, a poor choice of prayers, antiphons, and hymns for the Mass and for Masses in the Divine Office, and some of them you'll read it through, very poor choice of Gospels and Epistles for whatever season or purpose is, horrible decisions, illogical, they don't even fit. They came out with this new invalid and illogical censures. You have to read my book on that, where they censure something, the same thing altogether as erroneous, suspect of heresy, close to heresy, heretical, and they give you all these lists of various different censures, and each one is completely different in how it applies to the position, and they say, these censures apply to all these 20 points, but we're not going to tell you which censure applies to which point. And then the censures themselves are illogical. They have about 4 or 5 different things in each censure, and you don't know what's being censured. Some of the stuff is even orthodox. Some of it is mixed with heretical. And you have no way of knowing, well, what are you actually censuring? Yeah, I have it in one of my books already. I already have it up on the internet, but we're going to have it in really more detail in my book on the Magisterium of the Catholic Church. So they came out with this new way of censoring things, which I call, and is truly, invalid and illogical. Then we have a new thing here with the councils. This is not even maybe an incompetence. This could even be, this really belongs in the area of suspect of heresy or gravely suspect of heresy. All the great councils in the early church, when they had in the beginning of the church, up to like even the year 1000 or 1100, what they had when they had heresiarchs, they would condemn them by name. So they didn't just condemn the heresy. They condemned the main propagators of the heresy. I'm going to give you an example of it in the Second Council of Constantinople in 553. If anyone does not anathematize Arius, Eumonius, Macedonius, Apollinarius, Nestorius, Eutyches, and Origen, as well as their heretical books, and also all other heresies, heretics who have already been condemned and anathematized by the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church and by the four holy synods before it, which have already been mentioned, and also all those who have thought or now think in the same way as the aforesaid heretics and who persist in their errors, even to death, let them be anathema. They're condemning them by name. What good is it to condemn the heresy and not warn you about the people that are doing it? Give me their names. Give me the name of their book, the books that they're promulgating. And each council would repeat the previous council condemnations of those heretics and add the new ones to it. So what happens under this so-called great council of Trent? Which I don't deny had a lot of good things in there, but it's invalid anyway. But what are we looking at in that particular council there? They did, when it's at the height of the Protestant rebellions, they didn't denounce one heresiarch by name. Not one. Not as so much as even one. And who did we have that should have been denounced in there by name? This is all part of non-punishmentalism and non-judgmentalism. They should have condemned by name, and I'm going to paraphrase, if anyone does not anathematize Huss, Wycliffe, Zwingli, Calvin, Luther, Henry VIII, and so forth and so on. Those names are gone, missing. What is all that about? What kind of a council is this? Non-judgmentalism, non-punishmentalism. As if heresy is just a thing that floats out there, and it doesn't really attach to any person, and there's no real danger in holding it, and heretics aren't to be condemned anymore. Why were these guys not mentioned in the so-called great Council of Trent, in which they put that bastard, notorious heretic Aquinas Summa on the altar next to the Bible? You bastards. And the popes that did that were practicing astrology and everything else. They were bums. And that's another, I don't even call it incompetence. These people will be accused of being gravely suspect of heresy on these points. By not warning the flock. Why did they do it? Because they wanted peace in the temple arena. Because you already had the Protestants rebelling. They didn't want to go to war and fight. They didn't want the Protestants to call them dirty names or to persecute them or to martyr them or to go to war against them. Because they didn't have the real spirit of martyrdom, which is twofold, to die and kill for Christ. And that's not just an incompetence, it's what I call a grave suspicion of heresy. It's like a sin of omission. And the invalid Vatican Council of 1870 did the same thing. There's no denunciations of anybody in there by name. And boy, you could add a whole slew of heretics added in there. But then, of course, these invalid councils that were held by apostate antipopes, they themselves would have to condemn themselves. This is all part of non-judgmentalism, non-punishmentalism, where you can never really absolutely, you're not denouncing or declaring heretics, giving them declaratory sentences. Then we get into the Catechism of Trent's errors. The Great Catechism of Trent. It's another book of folly. It is not great. It's firstly incompetent. It's not good. You can do a catechism much better than that. Now, I'm not saying everything's bad in it, but a lot of it's bad. The way it's organized is bad. It's got material heresies in there, and it's even got things where you may even consider heretical if you don't really take it in the right way. One example is in one section, they say there's two parts of the church, the church triumphant and the church militant. Two parts of the church. Now, everybody knows their basic catechism, that's heresy. There's a third part, purgatory, too, the church suffering. They left it out. But later on in the book, you read about it, and there it is. Incompetence and everyone are talking about the so-called baptism of desire and blood opinion. The allowable one, you know, where catechumens come in, which is an allowable... They have a paragraph in there that makes no sense whatsoever. It was written by an idiot. These guys are klutzes and dummies. We always say it when I'm doing my work here. And my sister Jane does my editing secretarial work. I say they got bugs in their brains. Bugs in their brains from studying that scholastic crap. A 7-year-old kid with the use of reason is smarter than these dummies that go to 22 years of school and come out learning that stuff. And that's just some of the incompetences. I got a whole list. And all their different buffooneries and all their different foolish teachings and ways of the scholastics and all these people from there on forward. And all their probabilism when they're treating dogmas as opinions and they're not judging or punishing anybody. This is something that you can look at and say, for someone to be able to do this, they had to have lost the faith long ago, or I say never even had it. It didn't happen overnight. You don't put pictures up like that on the door and get away with it unless most of the people are corrupted also. It started with scholasticism. It started with scholasticism. It started with scholasticism. That new way of talking, that new way of thinking that was alien to the church fathers. And scholasticism, folks, began to take root in the 12th century, the 1100s. Now, by looking at this door alone, you can see there was not one so-called pope from Eugenius IV forward that was a true pope, and not one cardinal that was a true cardinal. Each and every one of them was an apostate anti-pope, an apostate cardinal, because they're banned from holding offices, because of their idolaters, and they were formal heretics. From that point forward, every one of them. God will have nothing to do with people like that. He will not hear their prayers. He will not give them the respect of the office. We already taught that elsewhere. We're going to continue to teach it about them being banned from office. This crime has always been one of the highest, biggest abominations against God. It's against the first commandment. There's no way God will ever accept anybody like that as a leader of his church. And what you are going to find out in the future, and we're studying this, I already told you, the root of all this is scholasticism, the merging of philosophy with theology and using the philosophical methods and then bringing in the philosophers and glorifying them, being obsessed with them, which led to the Romans One Curse. Well, then you had Romans One Curse running rift with naked pictures and pornography from the 1130s, 1140s forward. And you're going to find out that even from that period to the 1445s, most were apostate anti-popes, even from that period of time. And you're going to see all the evidence I have in my book, Apostate Antipopes. This goes way back, folks. It's not just the Vatican II Church. That stuff you just looked at here should be enough for anybody who has even common sense. Even if he's a pagan, he's not a Catholic, says, what is this doing up on your door? I thought your God condemns these things. Is your God the true God or is he the true God? You can't have them both ways. Now, you may say that, well, okay, if this goes back to 1445, all right, which is true, you're showing us that. You were telling us that one of those panels on there was talking about pedophilia, you know, about the eagle Zeus taking that young boy and fornicating with him. Yeah, but surely back in 1445, they couldn't have been doing pedophilia. Oh, yeah? Well, we're going to read this to you right now. In the time of the apostate anti-pope Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, who everybody looks at him as the really big bad guy. He's not the only bad guy. There's a lot of guys that were just like him, equally as evil, and some even worse. So he's not the only wicked apostate anti-pope back in that era. But what we're going to talk about here is we're going to read again from the History of Popes by Dr. Ludwig Pasteur, and we're going to be reading from Volume 5, Chapter... Book 2, Chapter 5, pages 513 to 518. And I'm going to lead into you and tell you what's going on here. Several things, no matter how evil anybody is, even these apostate antipopes, God was always trying to get their attention to reform, to convert, to repent, to abjure. He would punish them with floods. He would punish them with plagues and pestilence. If you read the history of that, you will be amazed at how many punishments God had sent them. Even the Borgia Pope was sent many punishments from God. The one punishment that really got him to almost really do a reform was when his son Juan Borgia was killed. And when that happened, that really got to him, which is kind of really stupid. Shows how much he loved his son. Was the only thing that got his attention. God flooded Rome with a giant flood that was so bad they said you couldn't even see land. It looked like the whole of that part of Rome was covered with water. And when you read about all the people that died, that didn't get him to reform. Although he almost, I think he had another thing where the ceiling caved down in him when he was saying mass. That almost got him to reform, but he never really ultimately reformed. This was the time he almost really did it. And he wrote up a bull of reform in 1497. And included in that bull of reform, he alludes to the fact that these apostate cardinals were actually committing the sin of pedophilia with young boys. He alludes to that fact in here. Now, before we do the reading, I want to just mention one thing. The bull of reform he did write up, the cardinals gave him pressure, and he was under a lot of pressure not to really promulgate it, so he never did. It remained in draft form. And he never promulgated it. And then, as the story goes, after that, he became even worse than he ever was, the Borgia Pope. He became worse than he ever was. Now, the bad part about that whole reform bull, though, was he had a lot of good things in there that needed to be reformed. He didn't have the main things. Scholasticism, the glorification mythology, the tearing down of the idols that he himself had contributed to in the Borgia apartment. He had idols brought into the Borgia apartment and put them up in there. And they were practicing astrology. So the reform bull he wrote up was more about moral stuff. It had nothing to do with the key issues of faith that led them into this. But one of the things he talked about, and I'm going to read it here, alluded to the fact that these apostate cardinals were committing pedophilia with young boys. There is no doubt that in those sorrowful days of the summer of 1497, Alexander VI sincerely desired and intended to institute searching reforms. At last, the comprehensive bull of reform was drafted. The bull then proceeds to reform the reform of the College of Cardinals. The household of cardinals are not to employ boys and youths as body servants. He goes, these regulations are in themselves enough to show what abuses have crept into the College of Cardinals. They're being, if you really, now I have this, I don't know if you can read commentaries on it, but we have the whole bull of reform in Latin. But he's telling, you could allude to the fact of why he's telling the cardinals not to have boy servants on their body, boy body servants. That means they were messing around with little boys. And women, boys, adultery, animals, Lord only knows what else they were doing. All right? So, yes, pedophilia was back then. 1445, you got the Zeus in the form of an eagle raping this Ganymede boy. Right? And there comes that pedophilia demon right into the church, and they're committing it. And then it goes on to say here, unfortunately, the bull, which contained all these excellent provisions, but not enough, didn't go near far enough because he didn't hit the faith issues, never got beyond the draft stage. The work of reform was put off at first and then forgotten. So he never even promulgated that. And he had things against simony or that he himself was guilty of. So no matter how evil these guys are, you can see God working with them even, trying to turn them around, trying to wake them up. But yes, indeed, as you can see, pedophilia was bad back, was around back then even. And now we're going to look at just some more proof, out of an abundance of proof, showing that these guys were apostate anti-popes. And they weren't ashamed. This is the worst of all. Usually when you die, maybe you get some repentance, you do something a little bit holy. You got to, when you look at their tombs, we're going to now talk about the idolatrous and immodest tombs of these apostate anti-popes. It says everything you need to know, at least about these guys. Now, I'm not saying you could have had an apostate anti-pope who had a holy tomb with holy pictures, and he's still an apostate because he allowed these things. But in these particular cases, these which I'm going to show you, these tombs are inside St. Peter's Basilica, and they're also desecrating it. And you're going to notice when we go through these tombs, they have mythological virtue creatures all around their tombs. And not one of the tombs has one holy picture at all. Not even one. No picture of Jesus. No picture of Mary. No picture of Joseph. No picture of the good Saint Anne. No picture of John the Baptist. No picture of St. Elizabeth or St. Zachary. No picture of St. Peter or St. Paul. No picture of any of the apostles. No picture of Abraham. No picture of Moses. No picture of Noah. No picture of any of the Old Covenant Testament saints. No picture of the New Testament saints. Nothing from the Gospels. Nothing from the Epistles. All you got on the tombs are pagan these mythological virtue creatures bearing their breasts. That's all you're going to see on these tombs I'm going to rattle off at you. And you have to ask your question, is this a man that believed in God, the Catholic God, that feared God, that he should put this on his tomb as his final representation of his testimony of what he's done? All right, and we're going to go look at this. We're going to first go and we're going to look at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Innocent VIII, who was an apostate anti-pope from 1484 to 1492. In this picture, we see apostate anti-pope Innocent VIII bestowing an apostolic blessing, surrounded by seven mythological virtue creatures, representing the three theological virtues and the four cardinal virtues. The tomb was made in 1492. And again, you can see there's no Jesus, Mary, Joseph, nothing. No Old Testament, New Testament, saints or holy people. God, nothing. Now we look at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Gregory XIII, who was an apostate anti-pope from 1572 to 1585. And we notice on his tomb here, the immodest mythological virtue creature representing religion and another representing magnificence. Now we're looking at also the Medici coat of arms at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Leo XI, 1605. And what we see in here first is naked Pudi surrounding the Medici coat of arms at the tomb of Leo XI. And something very interesting as a side note, I mentioned on this Medici coat of arms. I always, as soon as I saw it, I said, that coat of arms looks like the false goddess Artemis. And some say it relates to Diana too, has many breasts. You'll see a picture of her with all these breasts hanging out. That's what that Medici coat of arms really looks like. And we know these guys were absolute one of the most diabolical and the number one financiers and promoters of all these evils that are taking place from scholasticism to the glorification mythology to simony and usury. These guys are one of the main agents and believe in infiltrators. This lends me to believe they made a pact and that they had some type of belief in this false goddess Artemis. Now we read here, on the Medici coat of arms, the number of balls has varied from 12 to 5. The Medici family had a history of devotion to the false goddess Artemis of Ephesus, who is always depicted in art as having many breasts. One could easily think that the balls on the Medici coat of arms to be yet another idolatrous representation of this false goddess. Now we're going to look at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Paul III, who was an apostate anti-pope from 1534 to 1549. At the top of the tomb is a statue of apostate anti-pope Paul III, and at the base are two mythological virtue creatures. The one on the left is called Justice. She was carved in the image of Giuliana Farnese, anti-pope Paul III's whore sister. Originally, this statue was completely naked, but scant clothing was later added after it was discovered that it was seductive and a moral stumbling block for monks and other religious. They found a monk abusing himself in front of it by looking at this naked breasts. The other mythological virtue creature is called Prudence, and she was carved in a likeness of the anti-pope's mother. And she is still half naked, bearing her breasts, right? They didn't cover her up, but she must have been old or something. They didn't worry about her breasts. I don't know what the thinking goes on with these people. But there he is. This is what you have on his tomb. No Jesus, no Mary, nothing holy at all, no saints. Now we're going to look at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Urban VIII, who was the apostate anti-pope from 1623 to 1644. We see two naked Pudi at the top and immodest mythological virtue creatures representing charity, with two naked children and another representing justice. Now we're going to look at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Clement X, 1670 to 1676. Surrounding the figure of the apostate anti-pope Clement X are two naked Pudi and two immodest mythological virtue creatures representing mercy and benignity, who is bearing both breasts. Now we're going to look at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Innocent XII, who was the Protestant anti-pope from 1691 to 1700. And we see surrounding the figure of the apostate anti-pope, Innocent XII, are two immodest mythological virtue creatures representing justice and charity, who is bearing both breasts. And now we're going to look at the tomb of apostate anti-pope Clement XIII, who was apostate anti-pope from 1758 to 1769. Beneath the statue of apostate anti-pope XIII, we see a mythological virtue creature representing religion, and a naked mythological genie creature known as the genie of the cenotaph. Here is a close-up of the mythological virtue creature religion. And notice that this resembles the pagan Statue of Liberty, another virtue, mythological virtue creature of liberty. That's what you can call the Statue of Liberty. This picture looks very close to the Statue of Liberty. And now we're going to show you the monument of the royal storks. Here we see naked funerary genii weeping at the tomb doors. This was originally sculpted naked in 1829. These genii eventually had metal pants added to cover their nudity, but those have now been removed, so they're naked again. And that's just some of the tombs that we're bringing up. Nothing religious, nothing holy, nothing Catholic, no Jesus, no Mary, no Joseph, and so forth. It's all, what kind of men are these? Now, I'm not saying, so don't come back and show me that you have some of these apostate anti-popes that had holy tombs with Jesus and Mary on it, that they're holy. It doesn't mean that. Those guys are apostates too. But this is an extreme representation of how bad you got to be to do these things. And not only to do these things, to allow them. And all the future apostate anti-popes allowed it. They didn't tear them down and say, this is disgusting. This is pagan. This is idolatrous. This is a desecration. Rip the tomb down. Take this guy and throw him out on unhallowed ground. Throw him in the Tiber at high tide. Throw him in the Tiber when you got maybe some sharks in there to eat them up. Get rid of them. No, they allowed it to stay in there down till today, as you just saw. We're now going to give you an example of an apostate antipope who allowed the idols to remain up on the door, allowed the apostate cardinals and other so-called Catholics to have the idols, but he himself just didn't like them. He thought it was wrong. He didn't prefer it, but he allowed it. And who is this? Apostate antipope Pius V. He's the one everybody says, oh, the great holy man, some holy man. He was a bastard. And this makes him even doubly guilty, more than the people who thought it was good. He knew it was wrong. He did not like it. I'm going to read it. I'm going to quote it from you. And so he got rid of the statues that were the mythological gods that were in his own papal apartment, and he was giving them away to cardinals, so-called cardinals. He said, here, you can have them. Put them up in your place. Instead of smashing them and saying, nobody puts them up. Instead of saying that every cardinal that has one of these statues up in his place is an idolater. If you don't smash it and abjure and come back into the church, I'm going to automatically declare, I'm going to put a declaratory sentence on you, I'm going to kill your ass. He didn't do that. He gave it away. He says, hey, you know, that's like me saying, I got a big Buddha in some. Hey, well, I don't like this Buddha, brother. Well, here, take this Buddha, you can put it up on your altar. That's what he was doing. That's Pius V. And he left the doors up and didn't do anything about it. And if he knew that it was wrong, and he knew it was, I would say to him, why is it wrong? Is it just simply a scandal? Is it against your personal preference? Well, he just happened to not like it personally, because if he knew why it was wrong, that it was a sin against the first commandment, that it was idolatry, he would not have allowed it. He would not have given those statues away to others. He would not have allowed the door to remain up and to go in that place. We're going to read about it now on this bastard, Pius V, and the History of Popes by Dr. Ludwig Pasteur from 1898 is this book, and it's volume 17, pages 110 to 115. I can narrow you down on that by books and chapters. If you look at my book, I'll have that. Now we're going to read on this. The attitude of Pius V towards art has been misjudged in more than one respect. He laid himself open to this by an enactment by which he placed himself in direct opposition to the popes of the age of the Renaissance. On February 10th, 1566, it was learned in the city that the pope had made over to the Roman people all the antique statues which were in the theater of the Belvedere and its surroundings, and had charged some of the nobles to have them moved to the capital. It was further said that the priceless treasures which stood in the cortile of the Belvedere, and which had been protected from rain and risk of injury by screens in the time of Pius IV, were to share the same fate. The Pope's reason for this was that it was unfitting that the successor of St. Peter should have pagan images in the palace. It was just unfitting. It just doesn't look right. Is that all it is? It's not idolatry? So what does he do? He gives them to other people and lets them keep them up, and he leaves it up on the door, though. He just doesn't want it in the papal palace. It's just unfitting. In view of the enthusiasm for sculpture then prevalent in Rome, it is not surprising that the proposal of the Pope should have aroused much opposition, even from many of the cardinals, and it was due to their remonstrances that the famous antiques in the gallery of the statues in the Belvedere were retained in the Vatican. They said, please don't take them out of the Belvedere. Don't. He went, okay, I'll let you keep them in there. Now, if this guy really thought it was idolatry, it's not an if or an and or a but. Destroy the things, you're an idolaters. That's all. Pius, however, gave way to the entreaties of the cardinals on condition that the collection should remain closed to the public. You can have it hidden in the back room. But it still wasn't hidden, because in St. Peter's Basilica, which it was up at his time, the doors were there and the inside was already desecrated. He never did anything about that. The news that the Pope intended to purge his palace of antiques, it was just his own personal palace, antiques of idols, aroused the mind of so great a connoisseur as the Emperor Maximian II to desire to obtain possession of some pieces of his own for his own collection. The Emperor Maximian II wanted to have them. Since, however, Pius V had in the meantime made a present of them of some of the statues to the cardinals, he was giving them to the cardinals, it was not easy to find any which would suit the emperor's purpose. He didn't have any left to give to the emperor. Oh, I got Venus here. Would you like to have Venus? Or did you want to have Zeus? I had Janus. Do you want the Janus head? No, put the bids in. What do you want? Here. In July 1569, two more than life-size statues were sent to him, Hercules and Aphrodite, which were followed some years later by three statues from the Villa Giulia. So he sent Maximilian II, I guess he found a Hercules and Aphrodite. He says, here's Hercules and Aphrodite. Is that okay for you? Will that please you? You can put that up in your palace. This is a pope of the church. This is a pope of God's Catholic Church giving idols to these emperors and kings and tell them they can keep them up in their palaces and show them to people? Mr. Pius V. He's not pious. Several pieces from the same place were also sent to Florence. Oh, boy, the home. As a gift to Francesco di, you guessed it, Medici, the eldest son of Cosimo. The agent of the Medici in Rome obtained from the Pope in March 1560 the gift of no fewer than 26 statues taken from the villa of Pius IV. So wow. he's giving them all away. 24, he's not smashing them. The pieces. He's not condemning them. All right. Now, the generosity of the Pope, which had stripped the villa's generosity of Julius III and Pius IV, aroused the fear in Rome that Pius V intended to make a clean sweep of all pagan remains in Rome. But he's giving it to other people. But you see, he didn't do it. In spring of 1569, the imperial agent Cusano announced to his master that the Pope intended not only to destroy the theater of the Belvedere, but also to lay hands on the Colosseum and the triumphal arches in order to remove the temptation from visitors to Rome to pay more attention to pagan than to Christian things. So here again, he's only worried about whether they're going to pay more attention. That's glorifying them. That's ultimate attention. The fear was expressed, as had been the case at the time of Adrian VI, that in order to obtain the material for the restoration of the churches, Pius would make an onslaught on the grandest monuments of Roman antiquity and reduce the statues to lime. Though it was soon realized that these fears were exaggerated. He didn't do it. Oh, the changes in the theater of the Belvedere were limited to the removal of the tiers of the seats, so that there might be no more public performances there, a thing which in the eyes of Pius V was unseemly in the palace of the head of Christendom. The Colosseum and the triumphal arches were quite unharmed, while much of the magnificent statuary with which the Renaissance popes had enriched the Vatican remained to excite the admiration of future visitors. such as the doors in St. Peter's Basilica and the inside of it. He didn't touch it. Left it. Just kept it right there. This was especially the case with the famous gallery of statues, which, though closed to public, was placed under the care of the Pope's physician, Michael Mercati, who was director of the botanical garden established by Pius on the Vatican Hill. All this shows that the reproach which has been leveled against Pius V, that he was the declared enemy of antiquity, is unjust. Granted, his great strictness as to the morals, yeah, he was not strict on morals. But his predecessors and people joining his own reign were practicing astrology, there was sodomy, there was pedophilia, there was usury, there was simony. Strict on morals, just like you say it about these apostate anti-popes of the Vatican II Church. They speak out against abortion. He's strict on morals. They speak about homos getting married, it's not good. Strict on morals. It was only to be expected that he would be scandalized by the many nude statues, as indeed had previously been the case with the northern visitors to Rome, but there is no evidence as to this, and the very fact that the Pope presented such statues to the Romans, as well as to the cardinals. He's saying, there's no evidence, I'm going to read it, that he really wasn't a total enemy against these statues, because the very fact that the Pope presented such statues to the Romans, as well as to the cardinals and princes, to be publicly exposed in their palaces, goes to show that he, in common with almost all Italians, felt no scruples on the subject. The fact that he gave them to other people and allowed them to show them proves he was not against them totally. He did not condemn them as idols. He didn't say it's idolatry. He didn't say that you people are idolaters. So he wasn't this great enemy. It's just his personal preference was, I don't like to happen like him. I don't like him, but you can have him, you see? If he had considered the exhibition of nude statues in his palace dangerous for himself, he would certainly have acted ruthlessly in that matter with others. And he didn't. He allowed it to stay up. They were all up in the Vatican, St. Peter's Basilica, under his reign. So there's so much for your so-called Pope, Pius V. He's an apostate anti-pope, an idolater, a formal heretic, immoral bastard. And the apostate anti-pope Pius X, he happened to not like the naked pictures. So now when he said Mass in one of those churches where there was naked pictures, he had them covered. But when he left, they took the cover off. And he left the naked pictures in all the other places. So what's the point, Mr. Apostate Antipope Pius X? Is that naked picture immoral and a mortal sin of immorality? If it is, why are you allowing it to stay up in St. Peter's Basilica and all the other churches? Why are you not saying tear them all down and ban everybody from going in there? And saying that this is a polluted church, it's desecrated. You know, if you even fornicate in a church, it's polluted, let alone have fornication and naked pictures up. So it was just against his personal preference. Oh, great. Look how great Pius X was. He covered the naked pictures. No, he didn't. He only did it when he was in there. Then he had the pictures taken off and he allowed everybody else to go in there. He's doubly guilty. Now, when you see things like this with all these particular false gods and idols up on the door in St. Peter's Basilica and within the basilica itself and all the other and a lot of the other churches in Rome and throughout Europe and throughout the world, even this desecration was being taken place in these one-time Catholic churches, you have to say, what else? These people were in love with this stuff, so they must have been doing other things that would prove that they are really idolizing and glorifying mythology. So, and I'm going to list just a few of these things right now that they were doing back then by glorifying false gods and false religions, by glorifying mythology. And you can read about this in more detail in my book, Apostate Antipopes, and my other book which I'm working on was Crimes and Punishments of the Great Apostasy. Now, they were practicing astrology. Oh, yes, indeed. Many of the apostate antipopes practiced astrology. That's a false religion. That's divination to the devil. They were actually practicing astrology. The Kabbalah. They were invoking pagan gods, such as by Jupiter, or, you know, stuff like that. And they were joking. They were saying, well, he didn't really mean it, you know. Or by Mars, or by the great Zeus. They were doing this stuff in their sermons and their lectures, and when they were speaking, they were taking the names of pagan gods, mythological gods, for their baptismal name. Now, that's different from people in the early church or people that were born as pagans, like Apollo, then converted and kept his name Apollo. That's different. These people had a Christian name, or they had, like, let's say, a basic name, and they were taking baptismal names for the pagan gods like Janus, Mars, and Venus. They were doing that. This is all going on back then, folks. They were referring to the apostate antipopes and apostate cardinals as gods. You're great as the god Mars. You're greater than the god Zeus. You're going to read about this. You're like the great god Bacchus. You know, and they were giving these adulations to these apostate antipopes, and the antipopes were accepting it and soaking it all in. You're going to read about all this. Sodomy was prevalent. Absolutely like a disease back. Sodomy was all over the place. With the prelates, with the clerics, with the priests, with the laymen. Sodomy was rampant. Pedophilia, we already mentioned that. Showed you and proved it to you through the quotes here. They were practicing usury. They were reading mythological books and stories for enlightenment and edification because they liked the religious stories of these false gods. Not for some historical purpose or educational purpose or because you're trying to get a documentary on it. No, they were enlightened by these things. They loved these books that were on the false religions and the false gods. And what did these guys do when they could not make up, when they said, gee, I want to have some more mythological books, you know? They were even trying to find, you had these apostate antipopes like Nicholas V going out and trying to find these things so we can have more of it. But what has happened even in modern day? They start making up their own mythology. J.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. That guy was a so-called Catholic. He was a notorious idolater, apostate, and heretic. And he was very famous. All your traditionalists like this is Lord of the Rings. What is Lord of the Rings? It's modern-day mythology. It's mythology. That's all it is. It's idolatrous. It's an abomination. And they read it. They like it. They love it. They're enamored by it. And J.R. Tolkien is looked up as a hero. The guy's a bum. So if they couldn't get enough of the old mythology, they start creating their own new mythology. That's an absolutely idolatrous, false gods and false religions, and J.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And you got a lot of people doing that today. So they may say, well, I agree, we can't read the Greek mythology and the Roman, but we're reading J.R. Tolkien. But I tell you, the people that like Tolkien, they like the mythology too. Mm-hmm. Usually goes hand in hand. They watch stuff like Star Trek and Star Wars. No, I'm not playing innocent. When I was a pagan out there, I looked at Star Trek and all that. I was a pagan. I abjured from all that. That's a false religion. It's mythology. It's false gods. See, what happens when you're lost and you don't have the true faith, people are always looking for what's going on out in that other world. So what are these apostate antipopes giving these people? Mythology. They're looking for what goes on out there. Hey, read this. The false story about creation and about mankind. So J.R. Tolkien is another thing that they were doing here. This guy, what was his name? His name was J.R. Tolkien, right?
Yeah.
And he had a whole series, didn't he, on that? He had a whole series on that. It is obvious, then, that from the evidence of the desecration of Catholic places with idols and immodesty and the other crimes of idolatry, heresy, and immorality, that which was prevalent among apostate and immoral Catholics, that Satan was unchained from his prison. What may not be so evident is that the cause of these crimes was scholasticism. Satan was chained in the 4th century, and thus the world started to become greatly depaganized. Idols were disrespected, hated, banned, smashed, and went into hiding. But 1,000 years later, in the 14th century, Satan was released from his prison, and thus the world started to become greatly repaganized. Idols were respected, loved, unbanned, unsmashed, and came out of hiding. Hence, more and more Catholic places began to be desecrated with idols. And it was scholasticism that led to this desecration. In 1228, Gregory IX, in his encyclical Ab Aegyptiis, condemns scholasticism as a perverse dogma because it glorifies philosophy. It first glorified philosophy by using the philosophical method of inquiring, questioning, and reasoning with theology, as the notorious heretic Peter Lombard's Books of Sentences did, and thus replaced the true theology used by Jesus, the apostles, and other church fathers. It then glorified philosophy by using philosophers in a positive light and by being obsessed with them, as the notorious heretic Thomas Aquinas' Summa did. It glorifies philosophers by using them for enlightenment or edification, and by being obsessed, or I should say possessed, with explaining the perverse revelations and dogmas of the philosophers. Instead of being only obsessed with explaining the revelations and dogmas of God and his Catholic faith. In the same encyclical, Gregory the Ninth warned that scholasticism leads to the glorification of idols in which the true God is either replaced or mixed with false gods. We read from that encyclical, and it was on the necessity of preserving theological terminology and tradition, from the letter Ab Egyptiis to the Theologians of Paris, July 7, 1228. Touched inwardly with sorrow of heart, we are filled with the bitterness of wormwood, because, as it has been brought to our attention, certain ones among you, distended like a skin by the spirit of vanity, are working with profane novelty to pass beyond the boundaries which the fathers have set. The understanding of the heavenly page limited by the fixed boundaries of expositions in the studies of the Holy Fathers, by inclining toward the philosophical doctrine of natural things, which it is not only rash but even profane to transgress, by extorted, nay rather distorted, expositions, they turn the sacred words divinely inspired to the sense of the doctrine of philosophers, who are ignorant of God. Do they not place the Ark of the Covenant by Dagon, 1 Samuel 5:2, instead of the image of Antiochus to be adored in the temple of the Lord? Therefore, lest the rash and perverse dogma of this kind, as a canker spreads and infects many and makes it necessary that Rachel bewail her lost sons, we order and strictly command by the authority of those present that entirely forsaken the poison mentioned above, without the leaven of worldly knowledge, that you teach theological purity, not adulterating the word of God by the creations of philosophers, lest around the altar of God you seem to wish to plant a grove contrary to the teaching of the Lord, and by the commingling of honey to cause the sacrifice of doctrine to ferment, which is to be presented with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, be content with the terminology established by the fathers. End quote. Hence, Gregory the Ninth teaches that the perverse dogma of scholasticism leads to the desecration of Catholic places with idols, with false gods. It leads to placing the Ark of the Covenant with the false god Dagon, to setting up the image of Antiochus of idols in the temple of God, and to planting a grove of idols contrary to the teaching of the Lord. Scholasticism began to gain ground in the 11th century. Before then, a few individuals dabbled with scholasticism, but it was quickly put down or ignored, and thus did not gain ground. And from the information I have, Catholic places began to be desecrated with idols in the 11th century. Although from the 9th century, Catholic places began to be desecrated with immodesty, but not with idols, such as a figure of Eve naked. Both scholasticism and the desecration of Catholic places with idols steadily progressed from the 11th century forward. For example, scholasticism finally took root in the 12th century when the notorious heretic Peter Lombard's heretical Books of Sentences became famous and greatly accepted. One proof that scholasticism leads to the desecration of Catholic places with idols is that the scholastics never condemned it or denounced those who supported it or allowed it. When scholasticism was at its height in the 15th century, when the notorious heretic Thomas Aquinas' heretical Summa was the standard theology textbook for the universities, the scholastics neither condemned as idolatry the Catholic places desecrated with idols, nor denounced as idolaters those who supported, allowed, or tolerated the desecrations. And all of them remained in religious communion with those who supported or allowed the desecrations. And some, if not all, of the scholastic universities and their churches or cathedrals were desecrated with idols. For example, the infamous grand entrance of the University of Salamanca, a scholastic hotbed, was desecrated with idols, as shown by the Protestant heretic Rick Steves.
A highlight of any visit to Salamanca is its famous university.
The oldest in Spain, it was established in the early 1200s and was one of Europe's leading centers of learning for 400 years. Today, while no longer so prestigious, it's laden with history and especially popular with American students for its excellent summer program.
The university's ornately decorated grand entrance is another example of Spain's fancy plateresque style. Let's follow the facade's symbolic meaning. The bottom part thanks King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel for the money to make the building. Finally, as a statement of the school's open-mindedness, the top honors the Pope while putting him in the company of pagan gods.
The great apostasy then began in the 11th century with scholasticism and the resultant desecration of Catholic places with idols. It took 300 years of the steady progress of these and other evils of going two steps forward and one backward from the 11th to the 14th centuries to provoke God to unchain Satan from his prison in the 14th century as a great punishment. In the same way, it took 300 years of the steady progress of Catholicism of going two steps forward and one backward from the 1st to the 4th centuries for God to allow Satan to be chained in the 4th century as a great reward. And Satan remained chained for 1,000 years until the 14th century. We read from the Book of the Apocalypse, chapter 20, verse 7. And when the 1,000 years shall be finished, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and he shall go forth and seduce the nations that are over the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, and shall gather them to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. You will now see how the Protestant heretic Rick Steves unknowingly speaks of the chaining and unchaining of Satan, of the depaganizing of the world that began with Holy Constantine the Great in the 4th century, and the repaganizing of the world that was in full bloom during the Renaissance era. He says that Milan went from being pagan before the time of Christ, then to being Christian in the 4th century in the days of Constantine, and then to being pagan again, being called the New Athens during the Renaissance era.
The importance of Milano is nothing new. 300 years before Christ, the Romans called this place Mediolanum, or the central place. And by the 4th century AD, it was the capital of the western half of the Roman Empire. It was from here that Emperor Constantine issued the Edict of Milan, which legalized Christianity in the year 313.
After struggling through the early Middle Ages, Milan rose to prominence under the powerful Visconti and Sforza families. By the time of the Renaissance, the city was called the New Athens and was enough of a cultural center for Leonardo da Vinci to call home.
Notice that in this next clip, what the heretic and Renaissance man Rick Steves calls darkness was the great light of Catholicism when it was flourishing in the beginning of the church and really up until around 1000 or 900. Hence, what he considers light is the darkness of the Renaissance. But he proves a point. He shows you that even he understands that something dramatic happened in Rome and in Europe, that it was now being repaganized. We go to the clip.
After Rome fell, Europe wallowed in centuries of relative darkness. There was little learning, commerce, or travel. Then, in about 1400, here in Florence, there was a Renaissance. It was a rebirth of the cultures of ancient Greece and Rome, which started here and swept across Europe. The Renaissance was an age of humanism. It was a confident time when business was respectable and excellence was rewarded. The church no longer put a ceiling on learning, and the great pre-Christian thinkers like Plato and Aristotle were in vogue.
Before the Renaissance, art was legitimate only if it glorified God. It sat deep in the niches of churches and came with a Bible story. With the Renaissance, man, now alert and standing on his own, steps out of the shadow of the church. This David, by the early Renaissance Florentine sculptor Donatello, is the first freestanding male nude sculpted in Europe in 1,000 years. It's art for art's sake, adorning not a church, but a rich man's courtyard. While the formal subject is still biblical, David slaying the giant, Goliath's severed head is at David's feet, in actuality, it's a classical nude, a celebration of the human body. A generation before, this would have been shocking. But in the Renaissance, it's art.
The first thing that must be commented upon is the blasphemous, sacrilegious statue you just took a look at of Holy King David. Now, I ask anybody who read the Bible, anybody who knows about faithful Jews, anybody who even has the natural law upon their heart, did David look like that? An effeminate? He looks like a woman with effeminate hips? He's butt naked? And he's got a stupid little fairy bird hat on? He looks like a fairy homosexual faggot. That is not King David. That is blasphemy. That is sacrilege. It's part of the Apocalypse 13 chapter, I think it's 5 to 8 or 3 to 5, where he says it was given to the Antichrist to blaspheme God's saint. That statue is an utter and absolute abomination. And if I was present with that guy in power over him, I would cut off his private parts and feed him to the dogs, and then I would peel his skin off, and I would pour vinegar on it, and I would hang him up in the public place. To Donatello. That's who did that. Donatello, that pig. That statue is an abomination against King David. And I have no doubt that God allowed King David, the holy King David, to condemn Donatello on when Donatello went before Jesus Christ in a particular judgment to hell and maybe slap him around a couple shots. That is an abomination. It's a fairy bird, faggot, effeminate-looking statue. And he says, and if it's true, that that was the first full-blown statue that was naked. But there were other naked pictures in cathedrals that were half-statue, or like carvings into walls and all that. That was even in the late, as I mentioned before, in the late 900s. You had certain things of Eve being naked, but they were carved into the wall. This is a full-blown statue. He may not be correct about that, but maybe he is. But here's the point that's being made. You take a look at this thing. A holy Jew walking around with no clothes on? Out in public and all that? What is this all about? This is an abomination. Oh, this Rick Steves and a lot of other people just love stuff like that. You can only imagine what some of these guys were doing in the back room. These guys were as bad as the people are today. All right, now. Consequently, many so-called popes from the 11th century to 1445 were apostate antipopes because they favored or allowed scholasticism or the desecration of Catholic places with idols and immodesty. And from June 26, 1445, when the doors of St. Peter's Basilica were desecrated with idols and immodesty, all of the so-called popes were apostate antipopes since the desecration remains, even unto this day. And that's the earliest information I have of the churches in Rome being desecrated. If there happens to be evidence there was another church in Rome that was desecrated with idols or immodesty before this date, then that's the date we go forward. Now, anybody that reads the Catholic Bible and knows the Catholic faith already knows what's going to happen to these desecrated places. God always and eventually destroys all idols and all false gods and all immorality and modesty that desecrate his holy places. You just got to read the Bible to know that. He eventually does so. Sometimes he waits for a while and he tries to get them to convert. And he punishes them with some mediocre punishments, with not a grand severe punishment. He did that with the Jews during the Old Covenant era. He would throw down punishments on them. Jeremiah would say, if you turn back to your God now and get rid of the idols and get rid of your false gods and take them out of the temple, I will not destroy the temple. I will not burn it. But the Jews did not listen. And because they did not listen, God then utterly destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. The same thing is going to happen to St. Peter's Basilica. And I believe all the desecrated holy places in Europe and elsewhere, God's going to destroy them utterly. Because they've been committing these crimes for so long, they're numerous and they're prolonged. And it's been going on for a long time and they haven't been listening. If you even look at the history when these desecrations began and really started to grow big, they began in the 11th century and really and it was only minor then, and then grew really big into the 13th, 14th, and 15th century, and it was all over the place. And God was punishing them. He sent them the Black Plague. He sent them plague after plague. He destroyed their parts of their churches. He even sent the Western Schism, the Babylonian exile. God was punishing them. And what God was saying to them, these apostate antipopes, turn back to me and stop. Because if you don't, I eventually will destroy these places and level them to the ground. Now, for the past couple hundred years, God has not been punishing them anymore. He has not been even doing anything noticeably to them that would be perceived as a punishment. And that's because God turned them over to the operation of error. And that's the worst curse you could ever be under. When God finally abandons you to your sins and allows you to go on for so long committing these sins without even punishing you. When that happens, you're in big trouble. And then when God punishes you after your numerous and prolonged desecrations, He then will, at that point, utterly destroy you. For example, the numerous and prolonged desecrations by the apostate Jews during the Old Covenant era, who were residing in the northern kingdom of Israel, went unpunished by God for about 150 years. And they were going on sinning boldly, thinking in false confidence and false prosperity. But God will not be mocked. And eventually, He did. He destroyed them. He sent in the Assyrians to take them into the Assyrian captivity, down till today. The southern kingdom, the same thing. The apostate Jews in the southern kingdom of Judah were desecrating God's holy places for 400 years without any real severe punishments until God finally punished them by sending in King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and he destroyed the temple and took them into the Babylonian captivity. So eventually, even after 400 years, they got it. So you can say, boy, Vatican City's been unpunished for hundreds of years. That means God must be blessing them and there's nothing wrong with them. No, it's the complete opposite. When you see, in this case we know, because our Catholic faith tells that, when you have idols and immodesty and naked pictures and heresies and apostate antipopes in that Vatican, there's no way God can bless it. And when God stops punishing them, that means they're under the worst curse you can ever be. And in the end, when God finally does punish them, it's going to be unto utter and total destruction. Without any mercy, without any chance to save any of these holy places. And that's why you're going to see God is going to destroy St. Peter's Basilica, and I believe all the desecrated holy places in Europe, utterly destroy them, and he's going to either let the Antichrist do it with his armies, or God himself is going to do it by some natural catastrophe. For more information, see my book, The Desecration of Catholic Places, the chapter titled, God Will Destroy Most, If Not All, of the Desecrated Places. I'm now going to speak about the Catholic way to look at idols and false gods. Pictures or statues of idols and false gods could be displayed in books such as catechisms, Bible dictionaries, or historical books, or in a movie, documentary, or museum. As long as they present the idols or false gods in a negative light, and all immodesty and pornography are censured. To be presented in a negative light means the idols or false gods must be condemned in a prominent place within the book, movie, documentary, or museum in which the idols or false gods are displayed. However, any presentation of pictures or statues of idols and false gods in a positive or neutral light, which do not have a Catholic warning contained in a prominent place, are forbidden because it does not condemn them. By not condemning them, it glorifies them. Anything short of condemning an idol or a false god is to glorify it. And pictures or statues of idols and false gods that are immodest or pornographic are also forbidden, even if they are presented in a negative light. Hence, without a dispensation, a Catholic is banned from reading or viewing a book, movie, documentary, or museum that presents idols and false gods in a positive or neutral light, or presents the idols of false gods immodestly or pornographically, even if they are presented in a negative light. A Catholic can only read or view these things without a dispensation after they have been censured by adding the condemnation of the idols and false gods in a prominent place within the book, movie, documentary, or museum, and by covering up or removing all immodesty and pornography. For example, a picture of Satan with Saint Michael stepping on Satan's head presents Satan in a negative light and thus is good. But a sole picture or statue of Jupiter, Venus, or Aristotle does not present the false god, false goddess, or pagan philosopher in a negative light, and thus glorifies and favors it, and hence is idolatrous, blasphemous, and scandalous. And if it is in a so-called Catholic place, it is also sacrilegious and desecrates the place and makes it a non-Catholic place. See RJMI book, The Desecration of Catholic Places. Places notoriously desecrated with idols or immodesty are non-Catholic places. An idol or a false god that is so immodest or pornographic that most or all of it must be covered could be accompanied by a description or simply described with modest words. For example, a statue or picture of the rape of Persephone must be almost completely covered to be shown and should have a description that Pluto is raping Persephone. In some cases, a description alone may suffice. For more information, see my article, The Catholic Way to Learn About or Look at Idols, False Gods, and False Religions. Anybody who condemns the Vatican II Church, rightly so because of their abominations, you better go back a lot further, as we just showed you today. And I'll tell you right now, anybody who looks at this video and sees this evidence and does not denounce everybody that allowed it or favored it and supported it and didn't do, had the power to do something about it and didn't do it about it and doesn't denounce them as idolatrous and former heretics, I don't want nothing to do with you. Don't call me. Don't email me. Don't speak to me. If you see me on the street, get on the other side. Don't even walk by me. Until you admit that. When you admit that, we will progress to the deeper dogma of how these guys had no office because they're banned from it. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Amen.
This recording was produced by Mary's Little Remnant, 302 East Joffrey Street, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, 87901-2878. And can be accessed on my St. John the Baptist website at www.johnthebaptist.us.